raise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting November 3rd. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. And some audio for this week's show was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for November 13th, 1755. The Penobscot Indians in Maine are declared to be enemies and rebels and traitors, and bounties are offered up to colonists for both male and female scalps. Also November 3rd, 1883, Supreme Court declares Native Americans are aliens in the United States lands. Also on this date in 1903 in Colombia, in the province of Panama, with the secret backing of President Roosevelt and the new Panama Canal Company, Panama secedes. It is hurriedly recognized by the United States government within 3 days, declaring that the patron of Panama is the United States of America. And surprise, grants permanent and perpetual lease to its now new patron, United States, all future Panama Canal use. Roosevelt sends in the United States Marines to force Colombia off their new lands. People, the time has
come. This is your radio reporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, November 3rd, in 1957, a dog named Laika became the first living being sent into space while aboard the Soviet Sputnik 2. Laika's preparation for 7 days of space in a tiny cabin took a great toll on her body. She was kept in progressively smaller cages for long periods of time, which deteriorated her health. The intense simulations also doubled her pulse and skyrocketed her blood pressure. The public was told decades later that Laika, who was a stray mixed hunting breed, died from stress and overheating hours after the launch. At the time, some scientists believed flights by non-human animals were necessary before human missions. But the Sputnik 2 mission and the U.S. use of chimpanzees for space exploration sparked a global debate about the mistreatment of animals and animal testing in the name of science. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
This Week in Radical History for November 4th, 1796. America signs the treaty with Tripoli, which includes the following statement, quote, "The government of the United States is not, in any sense, founded on Christian religion," unquote. There you go, right-wing nut jobs. Also, November 4th, 1933, 3,000 farmers demonstrate in Neillsville, Wisconsin. This action to free 3 jailed leaders in the milk strike. During the Depression, desperate farmers attempt to raise ruinous low milk prices set by the large dairy plants. Their preferred tactic was to halt milk production. Led by the Wisconsin Milk Pool, they gathered on roads leading into Wisconsin cities and dumped tons of fresh milk into the sewers. Violence erupts across the state, and a striker on the road near Madison is shot to death. To break the strike, the governor calls out the National Guard. Also in the state in 1977, CIA Director Helms pleads no contest to lying to the United States Senate about his and the U.S. administration's involvement in Chile.
Badges. We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Also on the state in 1984, Nicaragua, the nation holds its first free elections in 56 years. Sandinistas win by 63%. U.S. has a heart attack. Also on the state in 1988, prisoner B.C. Kimberlin is placed in solitary confinement until after the U.S. presidential elections for claiming that he sold marijuana to right-wing darling and vice president candidate Dan Quayle.
Badges. We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Okay, this is just too funny, and truth is often stranger than fiction. In 1993, right-wing blowhard Rush Limbaugh's book, See, I Told You So, goes on sale. In it, it states, if people are doing drugs, they ought to be accused, they ought to be convicted, they ought to be sent up. Well, in 2003, he was caught in the police sting doing drugs. After that conviction in 2006, he'd be found with having possession of someone else's Viagra while returning from Haiti, a notorious sex tourism spot for the rich and famous. And Rush Limbaugh would say on his radio show about the trip, I had a great time in the Dominican Republic. I wish I could tell you about it. Of course, he's never sent up, as his book suggests, to do to all drug users.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Popularized by the movie V on this date in 1605 in England, the gunpowder plot to blow up the English Parliament was detected while leader Guy Fawkes was captured.
I remember how the meaning of words began to change. How unfamiliar words like collateral and rendition became frightening. While things like Northfire and the Articles of Allegiance became powerful. I remember how different became dangerous. I still don't understand it. Why they hate us so much.
I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion. I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos. I want everyone to remember why they need us.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Also November 5th, 1855, Eugene Debs, labor activist, socialist politician, lives. His belief in the people was very genuine, and his vision of socialism, quite unlike the state machine pictured in Marx's Communist Manifesto, is quoted saying, hearing his views, I could not help exclaim, "Why, Mr. Debs, you're an anarchist." "Not Mr., but comrade," he corrected me. "Wouldn't you call me that?" clasping my hand warmly. He assured me he felt very close to the anarchists, that anarchism was the goal to strive for, and that all socialists should also be anarchists. Socialism to him was the only stepping stone to the ultimate ideal. So I guess that makes Obama halfway to being an anarchist, huh? Well, I wouldn't hold my breath. Also on November 5th, 1928 in Colombia, 5,000 banana workers strike against United Fruit Company owned by United States owners. 1,000 people would be killed to protect corporate profits. Also November 5, 1969, the Chicago 8 became the Chicago 7 when the mistrial was declared in the case of Bobby Sale and a new separate trial was ordered. After repeatedly asserting that his right to have an attorney of his own choosing or defend himself, Sale had been bound and gagged in the courtroom. He is sentenced to 4 years for contempt of court. The sentence is later reversed. Sale was never convicted of any connection with that week's charges from the Chicago DNC protests. Not learning from past mistakes, the government is now trying to prosecute under terrorism charges the RNC 8, eight Minneapolis activists. Their terrorism charges is related to the organizing against the RNC in St. Paul last month. Deja vu all over again.
People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Ayanna Hayes. On this day, November 7, 1837, white abolitionist Elijah P. Lovejoy was shot and killed by a mob of pro-slavery partisans in Alton, Illinois, where he was the editor of abolitionist newspaper called the Alton Observer. Pro-slavery groups in Illinois had previously destroyed three of Lovejoy's printing press by violently seizing them and throwing them into the river. When word got around that a new printing press was to be delivered, a mob of people surrounded the printing warehouse in an attempt to burn it down. Lovejoy was killed with a shotgun as he attempted to stop the pro-slavery mob from entering the building. I guess the fight for independent media in America has been going on for a long time. Yeah, I said it. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Ayanna Hayes, reminding you, never let your past slip away.
Also November 6, 1887, Eugene Pottier, poet and revolutionary, dies. Participant in the Revolution of 1848 and elected to the Paris Commune. Condemned to death for his activities, Pottier fled to England and then the United States, later returned to France, where he continued writing poetry. He's best known today for the writing of the Internationale, which was put to music in 1888. The song, adapted by workers worldwide, is anarchistic to its core.
Change will not come from above. So for brothers and sisters, for the struggle carries on. The Internationale unites the world in song. So comrades, come rally, all this is thy time and place. The
Also on this date, November 6, in 2006, the Daily Bleed website, whose data I like to use for their show, had compiled databases to create this great service to all us radicals. Thank you to the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website, and happy anniversary. This week in Radical History for November 7, 1919, Palmer's reign of terror begins as 3,000 anarchists are imprisoned without bail at Ellis Island. You know where the Statue of Liberty stands nearby? Also November 7, 1936, the International Brigades, including Lincoln Brigade, sees its first action of fighting the fascists in Spain. Lastly, for November 7, 1959, the Taft-Hartley Act is invoked by the Supreme Court to break a steel strike. This act put major restrictions on labor ability to organize, the government effectively siding with and giving a lot of power to industrialists.
People, the time
has come. This is your radio reporter, Fashina Jones. On this day, November 8th, in 1800, a fire swept through the United States War Office, destroying the papers, records, and books that were stored there. Some government officials immediately suspected arson and possible political cover-up. America's complete military history prior to the 1800s was lost in the fire. Between 1784 and 1800, the War Department was responsible for veteran affairs, naval affairs, militia and army matters, as well as Indian affairs. The Secretary of War was allowed to spend 70% of the federal budget. The War Department was in overall control of internal security and diplomacy. I wonder what they could have possibly been trying to hide. Sounds a little shady to me. Yeah, I said it. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Fashina Jones, reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Say it, say it, say it.
Also November 8th, 1868, Powder River Country, including the Black Hills, is given to Lakota, quote, forever, unquote, by U.S. treaty. Within a decade, white settlers, business interests, and army would seize the entire region.
Badges. We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Also on that date in 1897, Dorothy Day is born. An American journalist turned anarchist, social activist, and ultimately a weird devotee of Catholicism. She became well known for her social justice campaigns, including defense of the poor, forsaken, hungry, and homeless. Day, founder of the Catholic Worker Movement in 1933, espoused nonviolence and hospitality for the impoverished and the downtrodden. Though the Catholic Church will never make her a saint, we'll gladly recognize her as such. On this date in 1974 in a federal court, charges are dropped against the 8 Ohio National Guardsmen for killing the 4 anti-war protesters at Kent State University. It was there on May 4, 1970, brave National Guards troops, called in to suppress student rioting in protest of the Vietnam War, killed the 4 Kent State students and injured 9 when they fired into the crowd with 60 rounds. The guardsmen literally appeared to have gotten away with murder. Previously undisclosed FBI files revealed that 1. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover felt the victims deserved to be shot. 2. Hoover eagerly followed Nixon's instructions to knock down, that is, to discredit, essentially accurate news reports of the shooting, and 3. That Hoover relayed the order and his top aides boasted that we scotched those accurate news reports.
Tin soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming, for dead in Ohio. Gotta get down to it, soldiers are cutting us down. Should have been done long ago. What if you knew her and found her dead on the ground? How can you run when you know?
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration for this piece came from the Slingshot organizer. Google the Slingshot Collective for more info. Audio for this week's show was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Google the Daily Bleed for more information. And happy birthday, Daily Bleed. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am always and forever yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Soldiers are cutting us down. Should have been gone long ago. What if you knew her and found her dead on the ground? How could you run when you know?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة تمتطي قوس من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Before we get to Raji Sarani, our featured guest this morning, we want to tell you about an important forum that is coming up that we hope you will attend. The forum is titled, The Right to Boycott, Defending BDS, and will be held on Saturday, October 29th at 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Central Square branch of the Cambridge Public Library on Pearl Street. As you probably know, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is gaining momentum around the globe, and the Israeli lobby is striking back. One of their moves is to get state legislatures to pass bills that provide punishments for businesses that support the BDS initiative. As usual, the argument is that supporting BDS is anti-Semitic. Such accusations continue to stampede governors and legislatures, which continue to bow to such arguments for fear of reprisals from the Jewish community. Even Governor Baker here in Massachusetts has bought into the argument and is supporting anti-BDS legislation. He must have been absent when they taught the First Amendment in his school. Boycotts are protected constitutional activity, but that evidently is unknown to Baker and his staff. The forum will address the context and origins of BDS in the struggle for justice in Palestine, governmental attempts to silence this movement across the U.S., and ways to fight back in Massachusetts. The forum will provide a platform for strategizing ways of countering anti-BDS legislation with participants, and we hope that you will be part of this process. Speakers at the forum will include Nadia Ben-Yosef, lawyer and the U.S. representative of Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel; Tamar Gabin, Palestinian-American organizer who currently works for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation as the Governmental Affairs Associate; and Susan Nicholson, retired attorney and member of the Mass Peace Action. We need to organize to protect the BDS movement here in our own backyard, so please make every effort to attend this forum. Again, it is Saturday, October 29th at 10 a.m. in the morning at the Central Square branch of the Cambridge Public Library on Pearl Street, between Green and Franklin Streets. And now on to our feature presentation. This morning you will hear Raji Sarani, the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, speaking at a forum entitled Palestine in Focus, Reports from the Ground, that was sponsored by Brooklyn for Peace. The forum was moderated by Jamil Dakwar, director of the ACLU Human Rights Program, and was held in the spring of 2016 in Brooklyn, New York.
So we're going to go get started. Thank you guys all for coming to Palestine in Focus, Reports from the Ground. So tonight we'll be hearing from a distinguished panel about how human rights organizations on the ground in Palestine have dealt with and are dealing with these widespread abuses of human dignity. Raji Sarani is the founder and director of the Gaza-based Palestinian Center for Human Rights, the center dedicated to promoting the rule of law and human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories. Holds special consultative status with the UN Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC, and is an affiliate of the International Commission of Jurists and in Geneva. The center conducts documentation and investigations of human rights abuses in Gaza. Mr. Sarani is also the 2013 recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. And finally, Jalil Dakwar is the moderator of our discussion. He is the director of the ACLU's Human Rights Project. So please join me in welcoming our guests.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Jamil Dakwar. I'm the director of the ACLU Human Rights Program. Raji can't travel to the West Bank and East Jerusalem, or Israel, for that matter. He's able to leave Gaza only when the Rafah crossing point is now controlled by Egypt, but obviously with the overall control by Israel, opens. And that has been extremely difficult for him to get out, just like many Gazans. I will start with Raji Sarani, the founding director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Raji?
Thank you, Jamil. This is a very proper introduction. And very grateful, I mean, having this event here at the university. Thank you all, I mean, for attending and for organizing this. New York for me means something special. Three things. One, it was the first place to leave. Two, after 17 years of restrictions by the Israeli occupation forces, and they restricted me with sex conditions. I will not go to details. But my wife said, even warriors, even fighters need some time to rest. And it's about time to rest. And I have been at Columbia University for some time. It was great to sit, reflect, and look to that part of the world from a distance. Second, I knew at the time great people who influenced my life in a way, and I was lucky to meet with them. I met Edward Said, Richard Falk, Chomsky, Jamil Dakwar, and others. I mean, and I was lucky, I mean, you know, having this quality of people and to have very direct contact. They are forming the creme de la creme of the intellect in this part of the world and the academia. The third, I was thinking when I'm in Gaza, I'm heading to New York. For God's sake, whom I would know, I mean, in New York. And fortunately, I was extremely lucky. It was only 1 week, and then I was busy for the coming 2-3 months. A lot of friends, a lot of support, a lot of people interested in the cause. Unlike many have the wrong impression, I think this country has great potential and great people who support just, fair, right causes, among them Palestine and the Palestinian people. So if the government on the wrong side of history, people are in the right side of history. Now, Gaza, it has been written in the Old Testament, forgetting from God's face, is it? 10 years ago, we had fantastic elections in Gaza. And immediately, 3 days after, Israel concluded that they have to sanction Gaza and Gazans. So they imposed unprecedented siege. And this was quickly supported by the quartet. It's unprecedented siege for two reasons. On the Iraqi embargo, there was restriction of movement of goods. But never, ever, Iraqi people, their movement were restricted. But in Gaza, there was restriction of movement for goods and individuals. So 2 million people locked in, and Israel controlling Gaza, land, air, sea, from all sides. Whether they say they are occupying Bar or not, the simple definition of the occupation, effective control on the life of civilians. Since 25th of January 2006, when we demonstrated elections, wonderful, great, transparent, democratic. Never I forget that day I was with President Carter touring in Gaza, in Shijaiya, Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia. And he said about 1 o'clock midday, Raj, it's over. You made it. You should be proud. I don't know where I am. Am I, you know, in France or in Austria? These elections going in fantastic way. You are in the wood of arms, and you are doing this. You are under occupation, and you are able to deliver this. You should be very proud. Because of that, because of this image, we should be held accountable, and we have to pay for it. They excuse the reason Hamas should be held accountable and they should be weakened. So the siege will weaken Hamas. We warned civilians, those who are the ones who will pay and will pay dearly and heavily for this criminal, illegal, inhuman siege, which forms sort of collective punishment. They didn't want to hear, neither the quartet or the Israelis. And this continued. This brought Gaza to have 60% unpaid or unemployed, 90% under poverty line, and 85% depend on their food and rations on UNRWA, World Food Program, other charities. So practically speaking, they are sending us to be nation of bigger, they are sending us to the Middle Ages, as literally, I mean, many of the Israeli leaders said. Are we so? We are freedom fighters. We are seeking an end and right of self-determination. We want end of the occupation. And we have no illiteracy in Gaza. And we have one of the highest university graduates percent in the world. We are hitting the record. We have very strong business community. We have enough capital. We didn't need one penny from anybody on earth. And we have very skilled working class. But that's what this criminal occupation about, to put it, to put us in such criminal conditions and to suffocate Gaza socially, economically, and the international community dumping some food and medicine. The fate of Gaza with this was more than enough to suffer and to have this level of suppression and oppression. But the occupation didn't satisfy with that. In 6 years, 2008-9, 2012, and 2014, Israel launched the three offensive in which literally civilians and civilian targets were in the eye of the storm, and they were really the target of the Israeli military forces. Gaza, 365 square kilometers, very small. It's called Gaza Strip. In it, 2 million people, more now. And it's the most dense populated area on Earth. 51 days in the last war, just an example, Israel used drones, Apache, 16s, rockets with the weight 2 tons, 985 kilos, gunboats, tanks, artillery, land-to-land missiles, indiscriminately, no safe haven, no safe place in Gaza. None of us thought next morning will come, he or she, or your family would be alive. It's your lottery number. Total discriminate bombing, killing, and there is no exception on that. Deleting entire families, 89 families has been deleted. I mean, people like Najjar family, 29 members, just the time of sunset, iftar of Ramadan, boom, the 29 members deleted. Hello family, 17. Batish, others, name it. And this goes unnoticed. Israel has the right of defending itself. That's Mr. Obama saying. And that's the Prime Minister of UK saying. More? Schools used to be as shelters for 570,000 people, their houses displayed, destroyed. And they just went to UNRWA schools, and UNRWA gave the GPS through locations where they are assigned, though they have been bombed and targeted, and tens of the families has been killed during this war. We have 3 fantastic towers in Gaza, like the Twin Towers. They are our Twin Towers. Basha building, Zafar building, and the Italian building, leveled within minutes for no reason. They destroyed our factories. Last 5 days of the war, almost 3,000 factories erased, including those who factories for biscuit, dairies, and they didn't satisfy with that. Even sewage system, bombs, has been destroyed. And according to that, the entire sewage went to the sea. Our power station has been bombed. Name it. I mean, nothing left. Tens of thousands of houses has been destroyed. In some areas like Beit Hanun, Shija'iyya, erased. Zanna, erased. Doesn't exist anymore. Hannibal doctrine has been applied in Rafah and Beit Hanun. And Dahya doctrine as well has been applied in many areas and places in Gaza. We are not, as human rights defenders organizations, are in defense of Hamas or Jihad or Fatah or PFLP. This is not our business. They are a resistance group. They can manage with themselves. They have their rules of engagements. We are talking about entirely civilian people. Rightly, as you said, 551 children has been killed. 400 32 women has been killed. I would imagine this number only. If it was Israeli, what will happen? There is no holy blood and unholy. There is no holy suffering and unholy. There is no holy pain and unholy. Every human blood should be dignified, respected. We said rule of law should be applicable in that part of the world. That's why we have to represent our victims. And we were doing this work under the bombing, under the killing. And we filed, I mean, all these cases, almost 1,100, to the Israeli MAG, Military Attorney General, who legally should be in charge of investigation any suspicious war crime. Flashback, he was the one before the war and after the war who said, my office examined from A to Z all the targets basket of the Israeli army, and we agreed on it. It's absolutely legitimate. It's the same one who proposed what's called amendment number 8 of the tort law, which says this amendment that if the Israeli prime minister, minister of defense, or commander of one of the areas, middle or southern or northern, declare a state of war, no accountability except on very personal accounts of soldiers or officers. So no accountability. We filed all these cases. Do we know in advance what is the result? And after almost 2 years, I can assure you one thing. We achieved zero level results. Of course, we launched very severe campaign against our president and the political leadership during the war to sign, ratify Rome status. Signed. And ratified Rome status. And we engaged, I mean, with this. But due to the pressure mounted by Israel, the oasis of democracy in the Middle East, and due to the pressure mounted by Europe and others, this was delayed, I mean, you know, for some time. The war was a real good opportunity for us to do that. And we managed, I mean, to pressure and to convince different political parties to agree on that. And we proceeded with the ICC, and we engaged Shawan, myself, other colleagues, with the ICC prosecutor. And we are going with that. They decided to make what's called preliminary examination stage, and this is going on. Hopefully it doesn't last like Colombia or Afghanistan. We don't have their tolerance. We want things, I mean, to move quickly and swiftly. They have all what they needed. Nothing in this conflict wasn't legally documented. Everything under control. And from there, we are engaging with this. Shawan Jabbarin and the staff of Al-Haq, it's not secret anymore, faced threats, death threats, because we are engaging with such quality of work. You know, to that extent, Israel and the Europeans and the American governments makes us feel as if the Palestinians who are the ones who are invented the Geneva Conventions. The Palestinians who are the one who invented universal jurisdiction. The Palestinians are the ones who invented the Rome Status and ICC. All what we want, simple and clear. Dignity for victims and their families, because we have no intention to be a good victims. Two, want accountability, accountability according to rule of law. International law, international humanitarian law, it's not there for intellectuals or academics, I mean, to discuss in the colleges or in the conference rooms. And we want accountability as a mechanism of deterrence and guarantee this doesn't happen again. The siege is a criminal. The war crimes should be there to be held accountable in a court of law. And as representative of victims, we have simple slogan. We have no right to forget or to forgive those who are committing war crimes at the daylight against Palestinian civilians. Thank you.
I'm just going to ask very short questions as a follow-up and give you a chance, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, either to relate to some other things that were said or to answer the question that I had in mind. You talked about the suffocation of the people in Gaza, and but still the resilience and how the people are fighting back in different ways, and particularly civilians figuring out a way to survive. Can you give us a sense of the rebuilding of Gaza, which, as you said, I think in the media was basically was sent back to the Middle Ages, and what we hear, only 3,000 homes out of the 18,000 homes destroyed have been built since the last war in 2014. Can you give us a sense of what is happening, going on with that, and what is the hope for the people, you know, on the horizon? What is it that you think you could be done in the short term to alleviate to lift the siege and the blockade in a way that will allow the Palestinians in Gaza to be able to regain more of their rights now that they are in that position? Can you say more about the reconstruction, if there's anything going on, what that means for the people in Gaza?
At the time, the European Baronet Ashton, at the time she was the European Foreign Commissioner, we were having a meeting with her in Gaza, and I said to her, I'm scared to death of one idea, that this siege will be institutionalized. And if this happens, this is real disaster. She said, no, don't even think of that. This is on our bodies. It's something temporary, we are sure, and we will not allow it to continue as such. First war happened, second offensive happened, and the third. In 6 years, away from all the killings, injuries, destruction, people want to go back to life after the war. So they want to rebuild farms, houses, hospitals, schools. Israel have the upper hand, and they do impose the siege. On the last offensive, the special envoy for Secretary General in the Middle East for peace process, His Excellency Robert Seri, struck a deal with the Israelis. OCHA comment on it. What they say? So according to the body of the UN, specialized body, yeah, they said if this happens, Gaza needs 20 years to reconstruct what has been destroyed. A couple of weeks ago, we were having a conference in Paris about Gaza. And the UNRWA director proudly said, we managed to rebuild 17 schools. And we handed over, in the last 6 months, about 300 units. I mean, so on this front, what's going big shame on international community? They are just leaving us for criminals. We don't ask, we don't want more than rule of law. It's not us, it's the ICRC, the Red Cross, says this is inhuman, illegal, war crime, collective punishment, should be lifted immediately. Not partially, but completely. There is absolute consensus between all international human rights organizations, UN bodies. It's not us who says that. Israel deliberately, intentionally doing this, and they want you as a Gazan not even to treat your water. Our water undrinkable. We have no right to treat our water because the chemicals which can use can be used for rockets and explosives. We are not allowed to treat our sewage because of the same reasons. You know, sometimes they make me feel that they are scared from security as if we, the Palestinians, have the nuclear arms. And as if we, the Palestinians, have the fifth strongest army on the world, we, the Palestinians, you know, strong enough to threaten the entire existence of this Israeli state. They want to monopolize the word victim. No other body can be a victim except a Jew, except Israeli Jew. We didn't persecute them. Europe did. And when they did, they came to us, to the safe haven, to the warm hearts. We hosted them, we received them. And we became the victim of the victim. 70 years after, they are victimizing us in the front of the whole world. They don't want this situation to change. They want to amount more and more pressure day and night. They want you to give up. They want you to leave. They don't want you to exist there. No other meaning. It's fantastic. I'm proud that I'm Palestinian. Honestly. I'm very proud. And I'm proud I'm Gazan. And I'm proud we are part of this. Because nobody giving up. And we have no right to give up. And we have no right to be good victims. And we know better than anybody else. We are in the right side of history. Right side of morals. And they can defeat us and be superior in anything except one thing. We will keep having our moral superiority in such a criminal occupation. Regarding one and two state solutions, to make the story short and simple, in 1974, Bruno Kreisky and Ulf Palme of Sweden approached Chairman Arafat, and they said to him, listen, But a CMPLO charter, very destructive, and you are calling for one state solution. And this is interpreted in Israel and the West, that it's a call for destruction of Israel. Are you really intending to destroy the state of Israel? Anyway, they concluded that he will recognize from Geneva the two-state solution, and he made this incredible political compromise. I mean, he compromised 78% of historical Palestine, and he said, yes, we are happy and ready to live in Gaza with Spain, including Jerusalem. Bruno Kreisky died, and Ulf Palma has been assassinated. And the promise of working hardly and swiftly to achieve and conclude Palestinian state never has been realized. Later been concluded with President Arafat, also accords, which we are not big fans of. And this was supposed to be confidence-building measure between the two parties and at the same time concluding Palestinian state in May 4th, 1999. Leit Rabin has been assassinated, definitely not by a Palestinian. And President Arafat was assassinated and definitely not by a Palestinian. All of us know who is there. Now, for us, believe me, this is very intellect discussion. We have no reference. If we call for one Palestinian state, they will say, aha, look to these people, they want to destroy the state of Israel. It's vice versa. They are calling for the Jewish state now. I don't know, is it Khomeini or the Pope in Rome? I mean, who's talking? These are the people who are, you know, supposedly the oasis of democracy in the Middle East. Now, of course, what Netanyahu and his encourage, you know, saying and doing, de facto and de jure, the fait accompli policy, no two-state solution. Now, for us, if they want one-state solution, we are happy and ready. If they want two-state solution, we are happy and ready. We are the stones of the valley. We know no power on earth will take us from there. And we know that we will be there as we have been since ever. We will continue there forever. But Israel should decide what they want. We know what we want. They don't know what they want. Now, this six conditions, I mean, it's a very long story. Now I'm blacklisted in the U.S. and I come with a special waiver. I mean, just, okay. But in 1990, a group of Columbia professors invited me as a way to come to Colombia at the time, you know, to join a course for young lawyers at Columbia Law School. So they worked very hard, and they get me out. And in Gaza, I was summoned. I didn't have, you know, any clue about it by the civil administration governor. And then I sat with the legal advisor, and he said to me, you can leave, but with six conditions. And these are a one-direct flight, Lod, Tel Aviv. You cannot go to any, Lod, New York. And the second, you are restricted to New York City. You are not allowed to be in touch with any PLO, you know, or any affiliate organizations with the PLO. You are not allowed to be in any public meetings or media or a press or lectures, whatever. You are not allowed to be in any connection with any organizations, anti-Israel, Zionism, or Judaism at all. I really didn't want to leave. I mean, but as I said to you, I mean, I'm happy, I'm working, I adjust myself, I leave the mathematics and the chemistry of Gaza. But really, we were tired, me and my wife. I has been imprisoned, I mean, like six consecutive times. My house, I mean, almost in weekly by weekly basis, raided my office, etc., harassment, summoning, admits. Amir, I am so part of that. I mean, anyway, in the end of the day, you need a break. And she said, New York, little bitter, little big bitter than Gaza. So let us, live there and to have some oxygen. Because it's long way to go. So under these conditions, we came to New York.
We unfortunately don't have more time for questions, but I want to give Raji and Shawan the last word, briefly to conclude, and then by that we will conclude our event.
To be open and very transparent and very frank, Palestinians always has been the victims of the Israelis. But the problem in the Israeli left, they always insist to think how we have to think and behave. And this is big wrong. I think we are mature enough and have mind enough to think and to know what we want. And nobody on earth in need of peace more than the suppressed and the oppressed. And I don't think Palestinians are exception in this. They are so passionate for peace, but we will have no right to give up. This is one. Second, everyone should know we are entitled for something called self-determination. It's our right and our obligation. We have the right to resist the occupation by all ways and means. We have no right to be a good victim. Last three wars, people like myself, because we are aging, we feel shame because we were sitting home. If I'm younger, with this death and the crimes, we'll take arms and fight those who are committing war crimes against our families, against our children, against our people in the daylight, in front of the whole world. And these war crimes were broadcasted live on air at the real time to the whole world. So we are entitled to self-determination. This is not intellectual discussion. This is first class, legal, political thing. And this is not classical occupation. This is belligerent, criminal occupation who do very systematic war crimes. We are not living in ease. We are not enjoying your soft life. And we have something, proverb in Arabic, we say, the one who count the slashes is not the one who is having good in their skin. We are having this pain and suffering for years and years and years. I was saying when I kicked off the discussion that it's a miracle. We don't have Daesh. We don't have ISIS in Gaza. Because all the ingredients they did to make you unbalanced, to make you giving up, have no hope in the future, and lose completely your strategic optimism. No, we are not losing our strategic optimism. We are not losing our wisdom. We are not losing our patience. We know this is unique conflict, but we will go with it irrelevant how painful it is. But once again, I think it's about time for the Israeli left to stop thinking on behalf of Palestinians. The second thing, I'm insisting to talk about Abu Kabir Hospital because I personally represent many dead in custody and outside custody, and I brought international experts from US, Netherlands, UK, and others. Always, always, we were having something wrong and something mysterious. And always the doctors we brought as representatives of victims said there is a big wrong and something. And they were denied having samples, having this, having that, etc. And always there was something wrong in this. What exploded this issue of parts and pieces of Palestinians, not because we are Palestinians, who cares? They stole, destroyed, transplanted this and that from Palestine. Who cares in Israel? It has been disclosed because they discovered the remains of Israeli soldiers inside the Abu Kabir. And they were used parts of it. And Yehuda Hass, who has been in charge of the autopsy department in Israel, the official governmental one, for almost 30 years, subjugated to very severe interrogation, and a little only has been leaked through the media, but that's, you know, in the end costed him to fire him and has been replaced. I don't want to talk about specific cases, but for you, the Americans, look to Richard Khoury case, and you will know a lot about it.
That was Raji Sarani, director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, speaking at a forum in Brooklyn, New York. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To hear the program later in the day, we realize that 8 a.m. on Sunday morning is awfully early for some, or to listen at any other time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org. All one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening. And we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
to BCFM's Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. Israel leads the way in surveillance and software, but does it give Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli government and the military a backdoor into the NSA and GCHQ if they're using it? Also, the old controversy, can the MMR vaccine cause autism? US manufacturer Merck are embroiled in a controversy also about the Alzheimer's drugs that they produce, as well as the MMR vaccine. But since a whistleblower, Dr. William Thompson, surfaced in the United States from the Center for Disease Control, it's pretty clear big money's trying to cover up links between the vaccine and autism. Why haven't we been told about it? Well, the film, which does, Vaxxed, has been censored. We start this week by looking at the Bristol Channel and Severn Estuary, home to four nuclear power station sites, Wilfer, Barkley, Oldbury and Hinkley. But it's a 50-foot or 15-metre tidal range means make it one of the two best spots in the whole world for renewable tidal power. The Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia, which is, funnily enough, where Genoese explorer John Cabot sailed from Bristol to in the Matthew and claimed it in 1497. That's the other place. Gloucestershire County surveyor Thomas Full James recognised the Severn Estuary's tidal power potential over 150 years ago, and his 1849 scheme included a bridge, the first design for a bridge across the Severn. At that point, I might add. There's also the MayGen scheme in Pentland off the northeast coast of Scotland. That's using enormous 400 megawatt underwater turbines. And it was opened by Nicola Sturgeon in mid-September with little recognition by the London media. So we're going to do the sums now and ask what's best for the Bristol Channel with environmental journalist Paul Mobbs. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Paul, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background?
I worked in the engineering industry 20-odd years ago. And then I sort of did my dream job, which was being an environmental consultant for community groups. And ever since, I've just been going around the country doing this, incinerators, landfills, contaminated land sites. If it's nasty, I've probably been there.
But when you say engineering, lots of different sorts, what were you actually doing?
I was an electrical mechanical engineer. And so when I go and look at an industrial site, that's really useful because I can understand what I'm looking at. And I do a lot of work around energy. And when you look at, let's say, a PV panel, there's all sorts of things that go into making that PV panel before you start getting...
That's a solar panel.
Yeah, a solar panel. Yeah, well, a solar electricity panel. Because this is one of the interesting things, the interesting arguments I have, that everybody looks at solar PV, the things you put in your roof to make electric. For every pound you were to put into it, you'd get 30 times more energy from a solar hot water panel. So why do people obsess about electricity? It's because electricity is considered to be more sexy than hot water.
Do these hot water panels, do they actually work then?
They work far better than the PV panels.
Why is that?
They will produce far more power in cloudy skies when PV panels will not.
So why is that?
It's because they're using a different bit of the electromagnetic spectrum to get energy from. They're using the infrared, which will shine through the clouds from the sun, even when there's not enough visible light to make the PV panels produce electricity.
Amazing. Well, that's something. First thing I've learnt this evening. I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot more. But look, what about our area here? The Bristol Channel really is, and always has been, one of the prime sites on the planet Earth. And Thomas Full James probably recognised this back in 1849, but still really nothing going on as regards tidal power. Why do you think that might be?
If I put my geek hat on, it's all due to the energy density of fuel, that the more energy you can pack into a smaller space, the more money you can make out of it. And the unique selling proposition of fossil fuels has always been that from a little bit of fuel, you get a lot of energy. Well, renewable power isn't like that. It's more diffuse. So you need some big equipment to capture it. If you think of wind turbines, you know, the size of a big wind turbine, it is big, because in order to get a lot of energy, you need big equipment. And it's the same for tidal power. Tidal power is, well, let's say the underwater tidal turbines they're building at the moment. Water is much more dense than air, about 800 times more dense. So for the same size turbine, you'll get 800 times more power than wind. So why haven't we done tidal turbines? It's because all the extra complexity of building something underwater, getting it out there, having divers to look after it, it's more complicated than doing it on the surface.
Well, we've been doing North Sea oil, haven't we, for decades?
North Sea oil is mostly big pieces of kit you go and dump in the sea. It's not quite the same level of finesse as you need to look after underwater equipment.
So have you got any theories why we've heard so little about this scheme up north of Scotland? Because, I mean, looking at you would expect that there would be almost a national celebration over this. The biggest tidal scheme in the world, MayGen is saying it is. It's at Pentland, which is just off the northeast coast of Scotland. These are massive, brand new, 400 megawatt underwater turbines. And like I say, the biggest one in the world was open the whole scheme started really just this September, and hardly a whisper about it at the same time as we were hearing all the fun and games in the national media about Hinkley Point.
Everybody talks about this government's policies on immigration or, you know, on climate change. You think about that attitude. They do not like renewables. To them, renewables are some kind of weird hippie-type thing that they shouldn't be looking at because it's not good for business.
Why?
Because that's their ideology. And we are living in times when politics has become extremely, after many years of sort of ebb and flow, we've got an extremely ideological government. And that's not good because that instantly shuts down whole areas of discussion. If you think of fracking, there is huge amounts of fracking. There was a bill in the Irish Parliament this week to ban fracking in Ireland. And we haven't heard anything about that. There are countries around the world banning fracking. Germany has recently banned fracking. We don't hear that in our news because our government is all for it. And it's because they see fossil fuels and, more importantly, big investment in big projects as being good for Britain. And if we think of Heathrow or Hinkley C or HS2, big projects, big money, that's how they see the world.
It's a bit sad, isn't it, when the government is thinking simply in a kind of almost lizard-brained point of view, well, we could have one or two mega schemes rather than lots of little schemes. Actually, for many of us, it's the smaller schemes, the more local schemes that are what we want.
Not just that, but from my engineering point of view, a big scheme is a single point of failure. They keep on about, oh, Hinkley C will be 7% of Britain's electricity. On paper, that's true. But it also means that if Hinkley C broke, then we lose 7% of our electricity. Whereas if you had lots of small schemes all over the place, working into local grids, distributed generation, all the stuff that the energy industry is looking to do instead of looking back, it's far more secure. It's far more secure from natural disasters, flooding or whatever. Don't forget that Hinkley Sea is on the Bristol Channel, where you theoretically could have a huge tidal surge like a Fukushima. So there are all sorts of reasons why, at an engineering level, energy technology level, and basic common sense, Hinkley Sea doesn't work.
What about the figures, though? Because most people would point the finger at both you and me and say, well, look, there's no way that tidal power is ever going to generate the sort of power that Hinkley would.
That's true. This is the problem. That, again, you remember I said about everybody looks at PV panels on roofs and thinks they're sexy. Whenever politicians talk about energy, they actually mean electricity. And electricity is only a fifth of what we consume. The other four-fifths is a mixture of home heating and road fuel. And that's the problem. We have a debate, even amongst the campaign groups, that is skewed towards electricity. And actually, electricity... yes, we need it for certain important things, but it's not the thing that makes our economy work.
Okay, electricity then. What would you like to see if you were involved a bit more? So, okay, let's give you the job, Secretary of State for the Environment or Energy or whatever. What would you like to see in order to put the nation straight on, number one, I suppose, reducing consumption of electricity, and number two, plotting a path into the future where renewables are taking over from fossil fuels and from nuclear?
There is an interesting argument at the moment that the government have just introduced, well, the government scrapped all the requirements for eco homes to reduce demand for new homes. But they've just introduced a requirement from a law from the last parliament that if you rent a home, it has to be a certain energy standard. And there's a huge lobby because it means landlords will have to invest in reducing the energy consumption of their buildings so that the tenants won't have to pay a fortune to heat them. And there is no simple solution here. If I were in charge, apart from the fact there will probably be a revolution very shortly afterwards, it's all about reducing demand. Now, we are reducing demand. We have been reducing our energy consumption in this country for the last 10 years. And that's for one very simple reason, recession. And if you look at the history of energy consumption, we have only ever cut energy consumption during recessions. Now, what this fundamentally comes down to is the laws of physics say you cannot have constant growth in a finite environment. And yet our entire political dialogue is all about creating constant growth. And so the first thing we have to sort out is not energy, it's the ideology that underpins all government decisions.
How do you do that?
Well, interestingly, the whole history of economic growth, everybody thinks that economic growth is inevitable. It's the thing that everybody, you know, has to do. Well, we've only had that policy in this country for 50 years. And even the man who invented that GDP figure in 1929, he resigned his job because he believed the American government wasn't using it in the way that he had invented it. And politicians can use this one very stupid figure to say that they're doing brilliantly. But actually, the whole economic growth thing, it's a bit like, you know, if you, over the water from Bristol, you've got Aberfoyle Power Station. And recently the government were crowing that they had spent a few hundred million pounds putting flue gas desulfurization on Aberfoyle Power Station so it could keep burning Welsh coal. Well, they've just had a European court judgment against the power station because it's emitting so high a level of nitrogen dioxide, it's harming people's health. So, again, there is no zero cost source of energy. But what it comes down to is you cannot have a constantly growing economy. And so my favorite, when I do talks, everybody has a mobile phone or a laptop. You are 5% of the life consumption of that device. So if you have a laptop, you use it for 2 years, the energy consumed where you're using it is about 5% of what it consumes. And that's because just making the memory chip in that laptop takes more energy than you ever put into it. So while we have an environment where you use a laptop for 2 years and then you junk it, well, yes, we're going to consume huge amounts of energy. It would be quite easy to make a laptop to last 20 years. I've got ones in my office that have been running for 10 years. If you can make goods last longer, you make them repairable, you make them serviceable, you're going to have a huge impact on how much energy and resources we use. The other big one is if you take the average person in Britain, you analyse their life, what makes them tick, you put more energy per person per day into your mouth in the form of food than you do into your house per person per day. And that's because of the way we produce food. So all those people in Bristol who do permaculture and have their allotments, they are doing far more to address climate change than the people who have green energy tariffs.
Okay, what about road fuel? I mean, you know, you brought the subject up, and it's a biggie, isn't it? I mean, we've got this wonderful metro bus being built here in Bristol right now, which is a guided bus scheme. Many people point to it as being a kind of almost pointless halfway house between the bus and the tram. But for many of us, we're tearing our hair out as trying to get back and forth to work is becoming more and more difficult, more and more congestion. There's got to be a better way, Paul.
Bus is a very useful little way of knocking more than three quarters off the road fuel budget. And don't forget that
buses don't go where you want them to go, though. The car does.
That's because people want to get in outside their house, go to where they want to and get out. And the fact is about cars, you know, you're paying for something, you're only using 2% of its life. And that's the point. Cars are a very good way of making people consume for something to sit and do nothing for most of its life.
The other thing, of course, is they're very handy for going out with the family at weekends as well, aren't they?
I've never had a car. I don't have a driving license. I travel all over the country. I work with groups all over the country. It's doable with the public transport system we have now. Admittedly, it's got difficult in the last year because they've chopped.
I think it's very brave of you, Paul. I mean, if it was me, I'd be tearing my hair out, because sometimes you think, we're looking at a journey, not only is it going to take you a whole day to get from A to B, and you then have to wonder how am I going to get back again, but also the cost.
Compared to having a car, I mean, this is the thing, that once you've got a car, you have an excuse to use it all the time. Whereas you look at the costs of not having a car versus having a car, it's not that much different. Because most of the time you have a car, it's not doing anything.
Okay, well, look, on this business of looking at these various sides of things, what about home heating? I mean, you've mentioned water, that you can have solar panel on your roof, which will heat your water up. What about, just generally central heating, or however you keep your home warm, making that so you're consuming less?
I have a lovely exercise I do. I get people in my talks to put their hands up and shake them, twist them. And the thing is, in this country, the average temperature of the house, measured by the building research establishment, is something about 21.5 degrees. For every degree you turn down the thermostat, you save 10% on your household heating. So if you go from 21 down to 17, which is doable, and you would acclimatise, it takes a few weeks, but you would acclimatise to that, you're saving 40% off your bill.
That sounds about the simplest thing, but I mean, you don't want to have to go around all the time with a woolly jumper on, do you?
Why not? Have you never seen a
You
Swedish?
Do that, I can imagine.
Have you never seen a Swedish... Actually, no, I'm sat here in shorts. Have you never seen a Swedish... whatever? You're talking about fashion. You're not talking about technology. You're talking about the stuff between people's ears.
Okay, well, let's get back to the Bristol Channel. That's where we started. Can you just give us an idea of the sort of costs and the possibility and the perhaps, you know, the actual benefits of having Tidal here rather than Hinkley? I mean, how does it all stack up financially?
Cost is a big one, because our government hides all sorts of subsidies through things like tax breaks. So the frackers at the moment are getting a 60% tax relief on all the money they spend, which is why a lot of people invest in things like fracking. It's a way of dodging tax on large sums of money.
Well, they're putting a big incentive onto that specific type of energy, aren't they?
It is, but there comes a point where the incentive is so great that people invest in it not because it's an energy source, but because it's a way of addressing their tax. And when it comes to the way we build and commission this stuff, if you can guarantee you're going to build 2,000, and government policy will not change. The problem we have at the moment is government policy is one thing. We have a different government come in, and the whole government policy gets junked, and everybody gets put out of work again. And that makes stuff expensive. That is adding to the cost of wind turbines or PV panels. If we can absolutely have a policy which people know that if they invest for 10 or 20 years, they're going to get their money back. It will be cheaper. But also, at the moment, the government is requiring all these companies to go off and get money on the commercial money market. If you look at Germany, various other countries, they go to the government and borrow the money from the government at a far cheaper rate. And that, in turn, means the energy is cheaper. And it's a bit more complicated than just how much does this piece of kit cost. It's all about how the government decides to invest. And at the moment, they've passed a law a couple of years ago that we have to maximise the economic recovery of fossil fuels in this country. And so they're all about encouraging fossil fuels, not about encouraging energy conservation. Energy conservation being the perfect example, whereas if you go buy a roll of stuff to put in your roof, you have to pay VAT on it. If it's a new build house, you don't. And so, again, everything is skewed towards consumption. It's not skewed towards minimising how much energy we're using or building the best solutions over the long term.
Now, I know you've done a little estimate for me, which was very kind of you, saying that you think that there would need to be about 2,660 tidal energy rigs. These are these things that they're building up in Scotland to make One Hinckley.
Yeah.
But I mean, what would be the differences in, I mean, you were talking there, I think it's just fascinating, this side of things, about just the finance for this. You know, so it may be that because this is money that's coming from the government, that the interest rates are so low, etc., that something becomes viable where another thing doesn't. What do you think it would cost to do something like that?
So let's look at Hinckley. The final price tag of Hinckley, there are huge variances in the price because everybody's looking at different things. Hinckley doesn't have to pay insurance for the major disasters. Our government picks up the tab for that. That's a subsidy. Hinckley, the money to pay to build it is coming from the French government and the Chinese government. So it's very low interest rates compared to somebody wanting to go and build tidal turbines where they have to go to the money market and they might be paying 4 or 5 times more for the interest rate. And so assessing Hinckley versus, let's say, Meigen has all sorts of problems because we're not looking at the same thing. But just on paper, with the stated price of Hinckley, if a Meigen turbine was less than £7 million, it's cheaper than Hinckley. And probably they are.
So, I mean, how do you work that one out?
Well, they spent £20 million on the prototype. And the thing about a prototype is it's lots of engineers having great fun cutting bits of metal and welding them together. And so it's very expensive. If you can turn that into a production line with hundreds of people in jobs...
Hey, that's a good idea. People need jobs.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. And then you turn that into, let's say, a 10-year project to keep those people in jobs. And, I mean, Denmark's really interesting. That we were world leaders in wind turbines in the 1970s. And then when Margaret Thatcher came in, we just junked the whole technology. Denmark picked all that up, and they have now got a huge export industry in Denmark sending wind turbines around the world. And this is the whole point. If you go forward and you develop these technologies, you're not just doing it for yourself. You're creating an industry where you can then export that technology to other people. Whereas we're importing the technology for Hinckley.
Frustrating, isn't it? So, I mean, is it fair to say that actually it could be viable doing a tidal version of Hinckley, even though it's a much, much bigger scheme, it would take much longer to finish?
I don't think the total time would be that much different, because if you look at the two other sites where the French are building these nuclear power stations, they're years behind schedule. In the end, it comes down to what does the government want. It actually doesn't come down to what people want. The vast majority of people in this country do not want fracking, and yet it's going ahead. It comes down to what government wants, and that's all about ideology. And at the moment, I mean, we look across the water to Trump and what Trump is thinking. Actually, we're there in this country with a lot of what Trump wants. We're cutting renewables, we're cutting science. I lecture on university courses, and one of those courses is being closed at the moment because people don't want to have the word sustainability on their CV because it might harm their employment prospects.
Well, hang on. What course is that? It's sad to hear that those important types of courses are closing. Which course is it?
I wouldn't like to identify the institution.
No, okay, but what's the course called?
It's Sustainable Development Advocacy. And the thing is that if you look at all the recent cuts to councils or companies, they're getting rid of the people who sit in offices and check if what the company is doing is legal from the environmental point of view. All those people are being cut.
That's tragic. Absolutely.
And the moment
tragic.
You start cutting those people, that means that people like me then have to go around and help the communities fight stuff which they shouldn't be having to fight because it's illegal.
Absolutely tragic, Paul. So sad to hear that. But look, I mean, on the other side of the fence, you've got the fossil fuel lobby, haven't you? The energy lobby, the nuclear lobby. These people are minted.
That's because they fit in with the ideology, the economic ideology. And ultimately, that's what economics is. It's an ideology. Economics is not a science. It's not... there's a man called Professor Paul Romer. He is one of the leading figures in macroeconomics. He is the man. He is the man who did endogenous growth theory in the 1980s, which Reagan and Thatcher worshipped. He brought out a paper in September saying, I don't know if this works anymore. I can't relate any of our theories to what's actually going on in the world. You haven't heard that on the news, have you? Because that throws into doubt all current government economic policy, because it might just be complete mumbo-jumbo.
Can you give us any specific examples about here in Britain where particular individuals have been lobbied or closely connected with, received money from these fossil fuel companies?
I did some research for a group called Talk Fracking at the beginning of the year. If you put Fracademic in Google, you'll find it.
And or your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google. Yep.
True, yep. But what this space is looking at is where the money is coming from for academia. Now, the thing is, George Osborne, he hobbled higher education by saying, if you want to do research, particularly postgraduate research, where we make our experts, you have to get into a scheme with some corporate funders. And so they developed these things called Centres for Doctoral Research. And so the fossil fuel companies are funding research into fossil fuels with government money and with private money at our universities. But of course, that means, in a way, the companies are getting to call what the university do and do not look at. So whereas before an academic could go along and look at quite a broad range of things, they're being forced by financial pressure to look at a very narrow set of things which just work into this big idea of big projects and big economic models.
So sorry to interrupt you, Paul, but any specific individuals, people that you know of in the British system?
Chris Smith would be the ideal example. He chaired something called the Shale Gas Task Force, and he appeared before a Commons committee last year saying that they were going to do all this independent research, and this independent research would state the safety case for fracking in Britain. It was funded by the fossil fuel companies and the people with interest in fracking. It was run by a PR company called Edelman, who have a long track record in fronting difficult issues for big carbon, big pharma and everybody else.
I mean, are we saying effectively that smaller industries like the wind power and the tidal power industries simply don't have the spare profits sloshing around in their bank accounts to hire these massive lobbying firms like Edelman? Because, I mean, those are the sorts of people who would have been involved in lobbying maybe perhaps for some big scheme like Hinkley.
That's pretty much it. Cars are a good example. There's various estimates, but about 10% of the price you pay for a car is to pay for its advertising. And a lot of really big industries spending 10, 20, 30 million quid to pay a PR company to set up lots of false Twitter accounts with robots tweeting for you. A lot of problem we have in the media today is that journalists are so rushed, they get whole packages sent to them, they can just cut and paste. And again, there's a lovely setup at the Wellcome Trust in London called the Science Media Centre. And I, as part of this academic work, I took Science Media Centre press releases and word searched with a computer program on the internet of all the major newspapers. And you can see how major newspapers just cut and paste this material from the Science Media Centre on things like GMOs, drugs, all sorts of things.
Well, we're going to be talking, actually, after we finish chatting to you, Paul, we're going to be talking about this film, Vaxxed, and listening to Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who's been fighting an uphill battle, really, a smear campaign against him for drawing, well, actually medically very watertight links between the MMR vaccine, which is manufactured by a big, powerful US drug firm, and Merck, and he has actually, I mean, if you go online and look for him, you'll find the discredited blah blah blah. Now it looks as if the pharmaceutical industry is a little bit like the energy industry, in that it's basically twisting the truth on the internet and in the mainstream media to its own designs.
And again, they're the people who tend to fund things like Science Media Centre. If you go to the Science Media Centre and look at who funds them, it's big engineering, weapons, nuclear power, big energy. And that's the whole point, that if you're somebody... I use Linux, which is free and open source software.
Is a replacement for Windows, basically.
It's not a replacement, it's better. And the reason you never hear of it, it's free and open source. You can download it for nothing. And they haven't got an advertising budget for that obvious reason. And this is a problem today, that the media, the internet, I mean, I was one of those people who got on the internet in the 1980s. And in the 1990s, we thought it was going to be brilliant. But it's been stitched up by big advertising.
Look, what about these wider questions? Fascinating to hear your analysis of, you know, the possibilities. Actually, we could be doing tidal power down in Bristol Channel. But what about the wider issues to do with climate change, for example? I mean, we've had some reports on this show over the last few weeks about the lack of sea ice, for example, around the North Pole. The fact that the North Pole is getting thinner, even though it might not look quite so bad from space. The actual amount of ice is getting thinner, and it's like the little ice cube in our gin and tonic is getting smaller and smaller.
Climate is only one of a number of different environmental pressures. The reason the government's latched onto climate was because it happens after the economic process, you can retrofit things and sell them. You know, there's eight things that are driving unsustainability, and actually climate isn't the worst. We're running out of certain resources, so the minerals in mobile phones, we're running out of those because they're not recycled. There's a whole load of different things, what we would consider essential to our everyday life, and they are running out. And it's because of this whole idea of growth and consumption. Now, some wonderful stuff came out a couple of years ago. Remember the limits to growth in 1972?
This is Club of Rome, infamous it. Club of Rome report.
They made a fatal mistake. They didn't label their axes. You know, you're drummed into it, you at school, you always label your axes. Various governments have sponsored reports to reassess the limits to growth model, and they all come back and say the same thing. It's spot on. It's one of the most successful projections in econometric history.
I mean, would it be fair to say that the more growth you get, the less quality of life? It does seem as if that's where we're heading.
Define quality of life.
Well, having, for example, having leisure time, that sort of thing.
Well, it's interesting you said about the hassle about taking a public transport journey. You have to get somewhere by a certain time. That is half the problem, that people are forced into cramming more and more in their everyday lives. But the thing is, you only have a finite amount of time. And in the end, you're multitasking different forms of consumption. You're washing up whilst watching the TV. You're doing your computer while watching Fox or something. And there's only so far that can go. And yet, and this was all foreseen. There was a lovely book in the 1970s called The Harried Leisure Class, which was written by a Harvard social economist. And he was saying the last barrier in economics is getting people to pay for their spare time. And everything he advocated in that book about basically monetizing us having spare time has happened. And that's the pressure that we feel today.
Well, I mean, I was just literally watching an interview with Prime Minister Harold Wilson from the 1970s the other day, and he had a big smile on his face saying, well, it looks as if, you know, we may actually start having a massive increase in our leisure time because of automation.
And that was the idea of automation, and it would mean that we didn't have to work. But if you look at women, they have been exploited more than anybody because they were exploited in the home. Then all these devices came along to make homework easier, but then they had to go out to work. And that, in a way, is that same process trying to exploit people to work more to get money. But as we start to approach these ecological limits and prices rise, which has been the case for the last 10 to 15 years, it gets harder and harder to make that model work.
Okay, well, look, let's get back to this climate change business, Paul, because I know you're pretty hot on it. Tell us where you think we're heading and if there are any models to stop global warming that are looking like they may actually work.
At the moment, we're heading for 6 degrees. We're heading for Armageddon. And there's no way off of that because if...
Well, why do you say 6 degrees? What's that?
Because if you look at the data of the current trends, and everybody thinks about it's just us who have to cut emissions. We have to cut emissions by a certain date, or the response of the environment will start releasing even more greenhouse gases. So as all that Arctic permafrost melts up in Siberia and northern Canada, it releases methane and carbon, which adds to the problem. And this is the whole thing about tipping points, that you only have to get to the tipping point and nature will do the rest. And because we're not addressing cutting very, very quickly in the short term, all the politicians want to kick it away to 2030 or after, we're not going to stop the tipping point. And that's why we're heading for a much hotter world than the political world likes to talk about.
Also, I mean, it's quite clear the Western world is pretty entirely addicted to oil, and it looks like that has been a deliberate policy since the Second World War, to get everybody addicted to oil. Everybody needs it, you know, filling up our cars with diesel, petrol, etc. What about peak oil? We haven't heard a lot about that recently. Is that what do you make of that, Paul?
I did some work last year. If you take the fracking oil and the Canadian tar sands out of the equation, then world oil consumption has stalled. It hasn't gone up in 10 years. And the thing is, this started 160 years ago. So you are going to get this long, drawn-out plateau where oil production will just sort of undulate at about the same level for 10 to 20 years, then start to fall. And you have to ask yourself, why are all of a sudden the Saudis wanting to sell their oil company? What do they know that we don't? And a lot of people who look at long-term energy trends, they're very suspicious of this sudden Saudi move, because as they see it, we are at this limit. And things like fracking are the perfect example of why we're at this limit, that if you have to put in 10 times the amount of engineering and money to get the same amount of fuel back, that's a perfect illustration that you're at the peak.
Also, I mean, there may be some geopolitical reasons why the Saudis might be being kind of persuaded to sell their own oil interests. I mean, certainly the West, whether it's Europe or the United States, the big energy companies here would love to get their hands on that.
What I love is the people I call economic fundamentalists, and they say we are never going to run out of anything because human ingenuity will solve the problem. We're going to go and mine the moon or something like that. And you look at the energy balance and all of those, it's negative. It takes more energy to get out than you put in. And if you look at something like tar sands, for every barrel of oil you put into the process, you're getting 1.5 to 2 back. And that isn't viable. Human society needs to get back at least 8 for every 1 it puts in, because otherwise you can't create the surplus in order to put into things like hospitals and schools and that sort of thing. So 50, 60 years ago, after the Second World War, our energy systems produced 100 barrels for every 1 barrel of energy we put in. And when the North Sea started, it was about 40 for every 1 we put in. And the latest North Sea, the deep water, that's down to about 20 for every 1 we put in. And so it isn't just this idea of the availability of energy, how much is actually flowing. It's the return, what we have to put in to get out. And at the moment, that is almost approaching parity.
What about a final sort of topic to look at, Paul, is this whole idea of clean coal. A firm has been claiming just a couple of weeks ago it's the world's first commercially viable zero-carbon power plant that could be a game-changer. This is Ian Johnston, who's the environment correspondent at The Independent. The company boss says the inventor of this new technique should get a Nobel Prize. A revolutionary technique to capture carbon emissions from coal-fired power stations has been shown to work on a commercially viable basis for the first time, the company behind it's claimed. If true, the breakthrough could allow coal to continue to be burned on a large scale around the world without actually producing the greenhouse gases that cause climate change. The Anglo-Indian firm Carbon Clean Solutions Limited produced its research, part funded by a $4.2 million grant from the UK government, and he said it could be a game changer. While carbon capture and storage systems have been tested on power stations, they've remained too expensive to make commercial sense until now.
It's better. It's definitely better. The two points are, number one, they've managed to shrink the amount of energy it takes to capture the carbon by about 20%. That still means you're using a fifth of the energy the power station generates to put the carbon into a form you can capture it. And then you have to find somewhere to put it, which is doable because we have all those old North Sea oil wells. So in the short term, it could be good. But in the long term, how much coal is there? Now, the industry loves to tell you there is, you know, so many years of coal. In the USA, the last few years, they've reassessed how much coal they've got, particularly places like the Powder River Basin in Wyoming. And they've been coming back with figures of 5 or 6% of what they actually thought they had, they can get out of the ground. And so again, a lot of these ideas for how much coal we have in the world are based on assumption using very back-of-the-envelope calculations for the size of coal seams in the area. When you actually look to go and dig these things up, you find there's a whole lot less than you thought there was. People keep saying, you know, we've got 200 years of coal in Britain. We haven't. With current mining technology, we've got somewhere between 10 and 20. Most of the coal we're digging up now is coming from open cast, from places like South Wales, where they're taking the last bits of mountain top off. And so, yeah, clean coal might be a short-term way of doing that. But all you're doing is creating a problem of where you put literally millions of tons of effluent, which has to be put somewhere where it's not going to come back to the biosphere. And we can only do that for a certain amount of time before we run out of space to put it, assuming the coal exists.
Well, there certainly is quite a bit in South Wales, Paul, isn't there? Is it? I mean, it's
no,
not
it's
as
not.
If it...
This is a fallacy. There is coal there, but you couldn't get it out because the geology means it wouldn't be viable to sink huge shafts down to where it is and exploit just a small pocket, because the way the ground is fractured means you can't have huge coal fields running for miles. You can only have very small ones taking out little pockets of coal. That's why they've gone to things like open cast, because that is the last viable coal we have in Britain. Now, there is this idea called underground coal gasification. Our government was all for this. In fact, it gave a huge loan guarantee to one of the companies wanting to do it. All those companies are now going into liquidation because they tried this in Queensland in Australia. Basically, you set fire to a coal seam underground, and a bit like the old town gas works, it produces gas, which you can then burn at the surface. They've contaminated an area around the site for 320 square kilometres with poisonous gases. And the view is that in 20 or 30 years, when those gases make it to the surface, it will kill the local agriculture. And the Queensland government is now facing hundreds of millions of claims for damages because the company's gone into liquidation and walked away.
Well, amazing. Anyway, Paul, it's been absolutely fascinating listening to you. Could you give us just some tips as to, I know you've written books, you've also got websites, that sort of thing. Whereabouts can we go to follow up some of your research?
The easiest one is to put my name into a web search. Most of it's true. But my website, Paul Mobbs, or Mobbs Environmental Investigations, that has lots of my old work on articles, even some very embarrassing videos, because most of my work is paid for by communities, so I put all my work online so that other communities can look at it and do something with it as well.
And what about books?
I've written various books. There's one called Energy Beyond Oil, which is just about available. That's all about peak oil in Britain and what it means for the future. I've written various books on... I used to do lots of work with journalists and human rights workers in Africa and the former Soviet republics, helping them get stories out about getting their heads kicked in by the secret police. And there's books on my website about that, how to use the internet safely, how to use free software, alternatives to Windows. Some of my latest work is around drones and surveillance technology, and I'm hoping there's a book coming out next year on fracking, if all goes well.
Well, since you've just mentioned that surveillance stuff, I'm going to ask you before you go just quickly about the Israeli role, if you know anything about it, in surveillance. There's a very good article just last week on The Intercept, which is based in Brazil, a very good surveillance website, was publishing a lot of the Edward Snowden revelations.
Yeah.
This is Alex Kane writing. He says in 1948, the year Israel was founded, the Meir Group was established as a metal company. Today it's very different. It operates a dozen subsidiaries and employs 1,200 people in 40 countries, selling wireless infrastructure and software for public transit, ticketing systems, wastewater treatment, and much more. The Meir's evolution came from cutting metal to electronic snooping and reflects a larger shift in the Israeli economy. Now, this is the sort of technology that Britain really could be dying for. They're absolutely right at the cutting edge of doing a lot of this surveillance technology. I mean, the main question really being, can you actually trust this software? Because you do wonder if it's being used in different countries for surveillance, whether the people who wrote the software have got access to it by one means or another.
The Israelis are the country developing drones, autonomous drones, surveillance capabilities, cyber war capabilities. And particularly things like drones and surveillance, that's because they have a whole country they practice it on to get it right. And in the end, it comes down to when you get a computer program, are you allowed to look at the code? And this is the fundamental difference between, let's say, Windows and Linux. With Windows, it's proprietary. You're not allowed to reveal what's in the code. Whereas with Linux, it's what's called open source. You can look at the code. You can understand how it works. And if you don't like it, change it. And all these things tend to be what they call proprietary systems. It's like a black box. You buy the black box and plug it in, and you have not a clue what's working inside. But again, this whole construct of intellectual property rights, black boxes, proprietary rights, it's all about control and growth. Governments needn't do this. There are plenty of open source alternatives. The whole internet runs on open source because it's cheap, because you haven't got all these proprietary rights extracting money. So the government is probably going for this company, again, because of lobbying. And there are alternatives available.
There's the Privacy International. This year is a watchdog group that investigates government surveillance, released a report on the global surveillance industry. It identified 27 Israeli surveillance companies, the highest number per capita of any country in the world. The Unit 8200 veterans either founded or occupy high-level positions at least eight of the Israeli surveillance company named by Privacy International, according to publicly available information. So certainly it seems, I mean, it's the first time I've come across this. I had no idea that the Israelis were so massively involved in all this.
Yeah.
And you've just mentioned drones too.
Oh, they are the people in drones. The bloke who runs the Reaper and Predator drone projects in America for the American government is a former Israeli.
Amazing. Anyway, Paul, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank
on
you.
The politics show this week.
Thank you.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
We'll have a look now, as I said when I was chatting with Paul just there, we're going to have a listen to an extract from this review of the documentary Vaxxed. And the man that started the controversy over the links between the MMR vaccine given to really tiny tots, literally just after they were born, was this chap, Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And as I said to Paul just there, if you go everywhere on the internet, you'll find almost everybody saying, or most of the web searches you'll do, say, oh, he's been discredited. But actually, this film Vax shows that there is, in fact, a whistleblower, a very important whistleblower at the US Center for Disease Control. And it's pretty clear that big money is trying to cover up links between the vaccine and autism. So let's hear one of the latest interviews and a review of the Vaxxed film from Andrew Wakefield now.
This is what we hear from the media, isn't it? We don't know what causes autism, but we know that vaccines don't. And it's actually a very straightforward story. It's not complex at all. Autism isn't this enigma. It's the disease of the last 100 years. It's appeared, it's gone from vanishingly low levels to now, as you say, potentially affecting one in two children by 2032. That is the most alarming epidemic that we've ever seen. I mean, it is absolutely extraordinary and will destroy the economy, will destroy the social infrastructure of this country and other countries around the world. I was looking at India just the other day. One in 66 children in India now have autism. They didn't even have a word for autism before it suddenly appeared out of nowhere. Now, the questions that have been raised about this, or the issues that have been put forward by the psychiatrists and psychologists, the experts, is that it's not a new disease. It's always been there. We just didn't recognize it. Or we're changing the diagnostic criteria, and children we historically called mentally retarded are now being called autistic, or we're just getting better at making the diagnosis. Now, those are reasonable ideas. They've been tested, and they're not true. It's important to bear in mind that the best diagnosticians in the history of medicine are not of this century or the last century, but of the century before. So, for example, like Charcot or Tourette, the great French physicians of the late 18th century. So, had autism existed, it would have been described. Now, go back to the clinical history, because this is the key. If you do not know the cause of the disease, listen to the patient or the patient's parents, because they will give you the clues. And the parents were saying they weren't anti-vaccine, they took their children to be vaccinated on time, but this is what happened to their child. they regressed into autism following the MMR vaccine. Now, we had to take that extremely seriously. They were right about the bowel disease. The medical profession was almost to a man and a woman wrong and said there's no problem, it's just autism. So when they were right about the bowel disease, we have to take the association with the MMR vaccine extremely seriously. And I believe that after all of the investigations we've done, they were right. And medicine says, well, parents are just looking for something to blame. No, they're not. Medicine is looking for something to blame. Medicine historically blamed the parents. It was the refrigerator mother who the child wanted to die because the mother was ice cold and hated them. This was the medical perception of autism in the very beginning. And then it was genetic. It was the parents' fault again. No, it's not genetic. You don't have genetic epidemics. And now the medical profession is trying to exonerate vaccines and blaming the parents again for themselves, looking for something to blame. So it's this circuitous argument that in fact comes down to the medical profession not having the answers and blaming the parents for the problem. People need to understand the seriousness of this issue, and we're at a critical juncture now in American history. This, I believe, we face the end of the First Republic of the United States of America if we do not act in the interests of the citizens rather than the corporations. And I think that we need to make some very, very difficult decisions about this. We need to stop being afraid. We need to stop being intimidated by the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry. We need to see them for what they are. And we need to take responsibility. Individuals need to take responsibility for this. It's no good just saying, what can I do? I can't do anything. It's too big for me. The underbelly of this whole system is the public saying, no, we no longer have confidence in what you're saying. We will make the decisions about what goes into our bodies and the bodies of our children. That is our right.
Well, that's Dr. Andrew Wakefield there, who supposedly discredited, but actually a fantastic amount of money seems to have been spent on trying to discredit him by people like Merck, the massive United States pharmaceutical company. And you can find out a lot more about that, very much up to date. It's Robert De Niro's film festival that Vaxxed. The VAXXED, the film, all about it, was due to be shown, and then it was pulled at the last minute. And there are quite a lot of interviews around on YouTube, online, etc., which go into the content of that film and take a really good look at the evidence behind it, because it seems pretty clear that these people involved, the professionals, got it wrong at an early stage. It's trying to say that there was no connection between MMR and autism. And now the things have gone so far that they just don't dare admit that they were so horrifically wrong. Rather frightening story there. And that was, as I said, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, you just heard.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Asma al-Assad is not a name we hear very much, but she's actually a British person. She was born here in Britain and brought up here, and she's the First Lady of Syria. She's the wife of President Assad. Now, many people have asked her over the years, so she says, about why she stayed in Syria. Since there's a civil war going on, wouldn't it have been a lot easier to leave? But she says that actually the reason that she stayed is because she thinks it's actually very important to stay in her country rather than to run off. So anyway, let's have a listen to a recent interview with her, because we hear so little about Asma Assad on the media here, and I think we should hear a little bit more. So here she is.
First of all, I've been here since the beginning, and I never thought of being anywhere else at all.
In Syria,
and secondly, yes, I was offered the opportunity to leave Syria, or rather to run from Syria. These offers included guarantees of safety and protection for my children, and even financial security. It doesn't take a genius to know what these people were really after. It was never about my well-being or my children. It was a deliberate attempt to shatter people's confidence in their president. And suffice to say, these offers were foolish and not even made by people who were Syrian. Why was the fate of the children in Zara not given the same media coverage as the tragedies of Aylan and Omran? The Western media decided to focus on these tragedies because it suited their media agenda. It's actually the West that is dividing our children in this conflict according to the political beliefs of their parents. Aylan was a Syrian child. irrespective of what his parents believed, as was Omran and the other innocent children in the Zara village massacre. These are all children. They are all innocent children. And they are all a loss to Syria, irrespective of which side of the conflict we support. And as a Syrian, I am personally saddened by the loss of every single child, whether it's Aylan or Omran or the many, many others whose names did not reach Western headlines. Ultimately, humanitarian aid should not be determined by geography, political orientation, or religious belief. It cannot be allowed to be driven by political agendas.
Asma al-Assad there, the Syrian First Lady. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. And also our sister show Dialect airs on BCFM here at noon every Tuesday. Our show page for your comments is thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Maliha Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib.
Maintenant, on va aller à la Casbah et avec ça, ils ne pourront pas te reconnaître. Tu as compris? Tu vas nous indiquer l'endroit où se cache Ali Lapointe. Après, tu seras libre. Donnez-lui une casquette et habillez-le.
Intégration.
Allons, allons, fais pas l'idiot, Lagua.
At age 50, the film The Battle of Algiers has never seemed so current as it continues to inspire, instruct and inform as much as it did when it first came out in 1966. What is it about this classic film that has so revolutionized the very medium of political cinema and continues to provoke thought and reflection, and whose lessons are still pondered in the world's movie theaters, university campuses, and military barracks long after its first showing? Late Palestinian intellectual Edward Said talks about the Battle of Algiers director Gillo Pontecorvo.
In the 1960s, two films by Gillo Pontecorvo, The Battle of Algiers and Burn, were perhaps the first time a European director had dealt explicitly with anti-colonial struggles against European powers. Political film style is uncompromising and yet lyrical and even redemptive. It influenced a whole generation of filmmakers, people like Oliver Stone, Costa Gavras, and Bertolucci. And the two films, Burn and The Battle of Algiers, stand unmatched and unexcelled since they were made in the 60s. Both films together constitute a political and aesthetic standard never again equaled.
The Italy of Pontecorvo's youth was dominated by Mussolini. As a middle-class Jew, Pontecorvo was expected to pursue an academic career. However, anti-Semitic laws were to restrict the opportunities open to young people with his background. But in Paris, he found the cultural and political atmosphere liberating. It was there that he met Picasso, Stravinsky, and Jean-Paul Sartre, among others. Still a young man, he went on to lead much of the opposition to fascism in Milan and northern Italy. He became head of the Communist Youth Organization and continued the struggle throughout the Second World War. He was only 24 years old. An imaginative and ingenious leader, his wartime experiences have clearly informed his film work. With the defeat of fascism in Europe, Italy celebrated the downfall of Mussolini's regime. The young war hero Pontecorvo chose to pursue a career as a photojournalist. On assignment in Paris, he was to see one of the classics of Italian neorealist cinema. He learned much from working with other directors. In Aldo Vergano's The Sun Also Rises, he was assistant director and also took the role of a partisan in the Italian resistance. Pontecorvo became detached from domestic politics after the war. Although he remained very much a man of the European left, the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956 forced him to quit the Italian Communist Party. In 1959, Pontecorvo directed his first feature film. Capo was one of the first films to depict the experiences of the concentration camps. He showed great flair in the handling of crowd scenes, which seemed to owe much to Eisenstein, as well as to Rossellini. But through Capo, Pontecorvo consolidated his working relationship with the scriptwriter Franco Solinas.
Mr. Bamhidi, in your opinion, does the FLN still have some chance of defeating the French army?
Selon moi, le FLN a beaucoup plus de chances de battre l'armée française que celle-ci n'en a d'arrêter le cours de l'histoire.
For this film, which was influenced by the ideas of Fanon and Gramsci, Pontecorvo used an extraordinary black and white documentary, grainy style. And he used a cast of Algerian non-professionals. One of them, Yassif Saadi, was the leader of the FLN in the Algiers Casbah. And he told the story not only of a group of individuals whom one could recognize and identify with, but he also told the story of what he called a choral personage, an emerging popular identity, a people coming out of colonial servitude after 130 years. In collaboration with Ennio Morricone, Pontecorvo created an innovative score that heightened the sense of tragedy while also addressing both Western and Algerian audiences. Despite French government objections, the Battle of Algiers won the Golden Lion at the 1966 Venice Film Festival. Nevertheless, it remained banned in France for over 4 years. The success of the Battle of Algiers had established Pontecorvo as a major player in Italian cinema. It had also marked him out as perhaps the most outspoken and politically committed filmmaker in Europe. The idea that human history is being made before us, human endeavor and human sacrifice, are very, very compelling, particularly in the present climate where there is no Pontecorvo making films. Yet in the end, I think his films leave us with a lot of questions. Questions like, can empires be defeated? Is there a possibility for relationships between Western societies and non-Western societies that are not based on oppression and discrimination?
In a recent piece, The Battle of Algiers at 50, from 1960s radicalism to the classrooms of West Point, Columbia University's Madeleine Dolby notes that the film has been acknowledged as an influence on everyone, from the Black Panthers to the Red Army faction to the military juntas of the Southern Cone. It may, however, have had the greatest impact in the U.S., where it has appealed both to scholars of colonial and post-colonial history, such as herself, and to members of the military and defense community. Khalil spoke with Professor Dolby about why this film has withstood the test of time.
Professor Dolby, before we begin, for full disclosure, I must tell you I was born during this Battle of Algiers, and by complete coincidence, even met the man who introduced the film to the troops in 2003. This was in Lexington, Kentucky, at the National Convention for Political Cartoons, of all places. And the man happened to introduce himself to me and tell me who he was and how proud he was. It was his idea to introduce the troops to this incredible movie. My family barely escaped alive from that whole violence that was happening at the time in the 50s. Two of my uncles were tortured during that battle, and one of them died as a result. And I know a few of the people portrayed in the movie. All that to tell you how central this story has been to my own life and political development. In your recent paper titled The Battle of Algiers at 50, from the 1960s radicalism to the classrooms of West Point, you make the argument that this 50-year-old film is as fresh today in some ways as it was when it first came out in 1966. Tell us why.
First of all, it's special to talk about the film with someone who has such a strong personal connection. And I'm, of course, moved and sorry to hear about your family history. It's a film that keeps being reinvented and repurposed. It's a film that we have to look at as a media event and as a political event in its own right, beyond its account of the events of the Algerian War of Independence. And what has always struck me about the film and what was really the inspiration for the piece is that as much as the film has inspired revolutionaries, radicals, either directly or more indirectly, philosophically, it has also been this powerful presence in military and policy circles. I've always known that. I kind of accepted it. I've often taught the film, and sometimes I've had among my students veterans or people who are currently serving in the military. And they have consistently told me that they've been shown the film at some point in their training. I guess, you know, thinking about the anniversary of the film coming up, I wanted to know more about that experience. And just to add something to that, I think the film has inspired an enormous amount of reflection on the part of scholars, academics, intellectuals of all kinds, and some wonderful things have been written about the film. To the extent that we on the left collectively have thought about the military approach to the film, and the assumption is that it's a kind of blind appropriation, that it's some kind of sign of naivete. But in a way, you know, we just kind of remain within a kind of self-reproducing binarism. So I wanted to go a little bit beyond that self-affirmation, or, you know, we're the revolutionaries, we're for the film, and you know, they take the wrong approach to it, and get a little bit deeper into what's actually going on. And some of what came out of that was surprising.
Yeah, that's what I like about your piece. It brings some new insight to the complexities of the film. It's not a flat film. It's not a Hollywood movie where you have good guys on one side and bad guys on the other.
Right.
The war of ideas, the war for hearts and minds, in addition to the actual war of repression, what Algerians still call the genocide. Mm-hmm. Algeria claims that 1.5 million people were killed, mostly Algerians, about 25,000 French. Mm-hmm. That this war was relevant to the U.S., which in Vietnam had sort of inherited the mantle of colonial master, even though it was not a colony of the U.S., from the French after their defeat in Dien Bien Phu in 1954. I learned a few years ago that the torturers of Algiers, some of them been recruited here in the School of the Americas in the 70s, among them General Osaras, to teach the incredible techniques that the French were applying, the torture and the counterinsurgency techniques, to teach them to the U.S. and to their stooges in Latin America, people like Daubuisson and El Salvador. What is it in this particular film, The Battle of Algiers, that has managed somehow to threaten many governments and inspire so many insurgency movements, guerrilla movements, etc., across the globe? What was it that has such potent effect on so many?
So to the extent that the film has inspired insurgents, revolutionaries, and as a result made governments and militaries nervous, there are a lot of things. Part of it is, of course, that it channels a zeitgeist. The period you're speaking of, the 60s into the 70s, is a moment of insurgency. So it's a moment of counter anti-colonial uprising all over the world. It's a moment when there are internal fractures in, you know, many nation states, and challenges are mounted to governments. And, you know, so the film is a work that channels that, maybe partly because of something that's often brought up in connection with it, which is that it is this international co-production. I mean, it channels the idea of an international political movement or consciousness in a very concrete sense that, you know, it has an Algerian and two Italian co-producers. The Italians are coming out of a commitment to communism, to the European left. The director, Giulio Pontecorvo, had been an important figure of the Italian resistance. Saad Yassif, who plays a version of himself in the film and who was the Algerian producer, obviously was coming directly out of his experience as revolutionary in Algeria. But he had grown up with an interest in the cinema, and the few films that he had seen included a lot of Italian neorealist movies that he found very inspiring. So that was one reason why he looked to Italy for a director to make the film. I think it's very significant that his impulse was to make this an international phenomenon. Just to back up a little bit, he had written a memoir of his experiences while he was in prison in France in late 50s, early 1960s, and that memoir was published in 62. And then in conjunction with René Vautier, important figure, French left-wing filmmaker who helped the Algerian nationalists, the FLN, the Front de Libération Nationale, to learn how to make films, propaganda films, I guess. So together with him, he made a film treatment based on the memoir. Then he wanted to find a director who would make this into a film, and ultimately settled on Pontecorvo for a number of reasons, but including this political affinity. But I think it's very important that the idea was to find someone outside of Algeria to do this. And so this really became a co-production, a collaboration that reflects this international spirit, this internationalist moment. So part of what you're touching on is this moment of revolutionary fervor and insurgency that explains the film channels what was going on in different parts of the world, and then has an effect of inspiring more of that elsewhere. You know, on the other side of the equation, the transfer of personnel who had been in the French military from Algeria to the Americas, to Latin America and the U.S. in the aftermath of the French defeat in Algeria. And that's also a really important story. In a sense, the other side of everything that the film is involved in, inspiring. So there were indeed a number of former French officers, including, you mentioned, Paul Osaras, who went on to train military personnel in Argentina, Chile, in particular in the context of those nations' dirty wars, and applied some of the techniques that they had first used in Algeria.
So it was nothing short of a stroke of genius to have found Gillo Pontecorvo. Nobody else, in my opinion, could have come up with this particular film, not just in content, but in its form. And it's incredibly innovative style. Tell us about what might have made this film even more powerful, the way that Pontecorvo approached it.
Pontecorvo is a fascinating figure, fascinating filmmaker. He made a series of political films about subjects that are really the most difficult to make visual representations of. So he made a film called Capo about the Holocaust. He made a film after Battle of Algiers called Quemada, or Burn, about colonialism in the Caribbean and about slavery and slave revolts. And he made this film about the Battle of Algiers. There are many interesting things to be said about Pontecorvo's techniques and why there was a kind of combustion that made this movie so powerful. Something that is brought up a lot is the way that he uses the techniques that come out of Italian neorealism. He used the expression dictatorship of truth. It's in a way a rather misleading expression. He famously used a quality of film that looks like newsreel. So the film has a kind of documentary quality that makes you feel that you're watching a newsreel account of the battle.
So many people came out of that film convinced they'd seen the documentary. It's clear that it's a feature film, but it felt like a documentary. The black and white, and right. Also his casting. Tell us about how he chose to cast his film.
Right. So the one aspect is the grainy black and white. He chose a particular caliber of film that would seem like newsreel. It's not in a kind of professional quality of film for a feature film at all. The casting, Pontecorvo is known for preferring non-actors, except for some very major roles. He cast Marlon Brando in the film about the Caribbean. And in Battle of Algiers, there's one professional actor, Jean Martin, who plays the leader of the French paratroopers, Colonel Mathieu. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they were people who Pontecorvo found on the streets of Algiers. And he was obsessed with finding the right face. And so he would, notoriously, he would spend days, sometimes weeks, scouring crowds to find the perfect face for a role. He immediately liked Saadi Yassef's face and wanted to cast him. He's a handsome face. I think it's a rather gentle face, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's also a very, I would say, quintessentially Mediterranean face, which makes him more universal in a way. Westerners might empathize with a face that's not too far from what they're used to looking at in the mirror. A lot of Algerians, like anywhere around the Mediterranean, it's a melting pot that doesn't know it's a melting pot. And that guy could have looked Italian, French, whatever. Yassef Saadi is a typical Algerian face, but quite universal in that way.
Yeah, that's been said, and I believe that Pontecorvo himself may have said something along those lines. It's an interesting, his face contrasts quite a bit with the very angular,
Ali Lapointe.
Yes. Face of Brahim Hagiag, who played Ali Lapointe, who was somebody who Pontecorvo saw in a crowd or found on the streets, and who needed a lot of coaching, apparently, to the point that Pontecorvo actually had to act out physically some of the scenes to show him what he wanted him to do, something that is not at all apparent from just watching the film. But I want to come back to what you said about the feeling that someone coming out of the movie might think that they were watching a documentary or a newsreel. When the film was nominated for an Oscar, a new title was introduced explaining that not a single foot of newsreel was used. So audiences were suddenly, in the print that was produced, were suddenly being told something additional about the film, which was, this is not a documentary, there's no newsreel used here. And you can interpret that in a number of ways, one being that the point for the Oscars was to highlight the artistry of the filmmakers, that the film was not appearing in a documentary category. This is a feature film, and it should be looked at as such. But perhaps also felt that people needed to be reminded that this is a narrative. It's narrated from a particular point of view. The film uses very cinematic techniques. In spite of the newsreel and the casting of non-professional actors, it's structured as a flashback, which is a technique associated with film noir, Hollywood detective films, for example.
It's also that hyper-realism that you mentioned that comes through this, picking people out of the street. To an Algerian, at least, it felt so real because these weren't actors and these were real streets that we all knew. It had that really powerful double take. We knew it wasn't a documentary, but it certainly felt like one.
Yes, you're right. I mean, it would have been completely different if it had not been filmed so close to the events, in the places where they happened, involving some of the people who no doubt had played a role of some kind or another during the war. They had the right look, they had the right clothing, and they were perhaps most important of all, they were speaking Algerian Arabic, they were speaking Darija, and they were speaking French in the film, as they naturally would in...
Yes, that funny mixture of French, Arabic, Berber, Turkish, that everybody speaks in Algiers.
Yeah.
One who gets less credit, perhaps, but also had a very powerful share, I think, in the success of the film is Ennio Morricone, an incredible musician, peerless, I think, when it comes to making music for films. But in Battle of Algiers, it really grips you from the start and never lets you go. Very powerful. It has been argued that Pontecorvo, though rather clearly sympathetic to the Algerian side, still managed to show complexities and consequences of violence from both sides. And perhaps that is one of the film's most enduring legacies. This was not a simplistic Hollywood-type movie with good guys and bad guys. Do you feel that this was also what lent it some of its credibility?
Absolutely. I'm thinking about the word credibility. What's interesting about the, you know, that what's often described as...
Or plausibility, let's say.
Yeah, plausibility, say. Perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, the even-handedness of the film. That's, of course, one reason why it does have an appeal across the political spectrum. So it doesn't just feel like a film that confirms what you already know. It doesn't just confirm your own political perspective. It tries to open up to a perspective that at face value seems to be unacceptable or the opposite of one that you could hold. Again, if we come back to how the film came about, Pontecorvo had a different screenplay. He had been interested in making a kind of psychological film about a French paratrooper. So this film was going to be called Para, and he had gone to Algiers with the idea of making that film. He had been introduced to Saadi Yassif, who had sent a representative to Rome looking for a director. And he tried to interest Saadi Yassif in that project. And Saadi Yassif said, no, you know, no one wants a film from a French perspective about a paratrooper. And this is just not what I, as an Algerian, want to do. And he had his screenplay, which Pontecorvo rejected as being a kind of reductive, heroic, ideological narrative. So somewhere between those two projects, emerged a project that encompasses more perspectives. And I think it was extremely important to Pontecorvo and not unimportant to Saadi Yassif to try to portray the French in a more subtle way than you might expect. Some left-wing observers of the film over the last five decades have been rather critical of that. And I think it does need to be said, and you know, you referred to the Algerian genocide. It does need to be said that even though the film contains these terrible depictions, these horrible depictions of torture, the reality was even worse. And the film, and this is something I touch on in the article, the film tends to treat torture as kind of muscular interrogation, a way of getting intelligence, of getting information. And that certainly was part of the story. But I think it's known that the use of torture in Algeria was extremely widespread. I think it's estimated by some historians that up to 40% of the population of the Kasbah was tortured at some point during those months of 1957 in which the city was under French military rule. And that torture wasn't just for getting answers. It was for purposes of humiliation and psychological warfare. All of that to say that the film could have gone much further in demonizing the French than it does. But for philosophical reasons and for its own kind of political reasons, it doesn't do that. But it portrays the French as rational, as having a clear objective and acting in such a way as to achieve that objective.
And that's Madeleine Dobie, Associate Professor of French and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, speaking with Khalil Bendib about the Battle of Algiers at 50. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Stay with us.
Leg, who was one of the famous people who were tortured during that war. And he wrote a seminal book about torture called La Question, as you know, that's been reprinted worldwide. And his estimation, torture, as you said, was much more than just going after information. It was a systematic way to humiliate and to subjugate and to terrify the population, regardless of whether individuals were involved or not involved. As I told you earlier, two of my uncles were tortured, and the one who was totally apolitical happened to be the one who died of the torture. The other one survived. And according to Henri Alleg, there's even some sexual facet to the use of torture. There's all sorts of psychological reasons why torture was happening. But it was interesting that in this country, on the occasion of shock and awe, and the aftermath, this became a very big subject, the use of waterboarding, for example, which is illustrated in the Battle of Algiers very graphically. The parallels between generally a war of counterinsurgency, whether it's in Algeria or in Vietnam or Latin America. Yeah, I had the book that's called Zara's Paradise about what happened in 2009 in Iran, a graphic novel. And I traveled the world with that graphic novel. And it finally occurred to me, just picking up a newspaper in Sao Paulo, Brazil, that torture was really a universal theme. It was not something that France had experienced and then practiced, that this country was grappling with. It was really pretty much a universal problem. That day in Sao Paulo, picked up the newspaper, and the front page was about torture. What had happened in the 70s and 80s during the dirty years of the dictatorship. Was it really torture? Was it not torture? Why did it happen? Perhaps it's also part of the reason the Battle of Algiers is so relevant to pretty much almost anywhere within the past 50 years. Which country has not known torture, has not known disappearances, has not known political repression?
Right, and of course, unfortunately, you know, one reason why the film has, if anything, had a significant revival in the last decade and a half has been not just a question of a dynamic between insurgency and counterinsurgency, but also the role of torture in that dynamic. And there are famous screenings of the film that happened in the United States in 2003, 2004, so at the Pentagon and Council on Foreign Relations and the White House. One of the things looming, the story of Abu Ghraib and the questions, you know, emerging in relation to Guantanamo. So a feeling that the moral question and political question of torture still remain very much in the balance. One interesting thing I think about the influence of the film is that I think it would be fair to say that it has been less influential in France, and perhaps, and this is more complicated, but perhaps also in Algeria, than it has been in some other places, and especially the United States. But the moment in France when it began to assume relevancy again was very much connected to the question of torture and to the issue that you brought up, which is the place of sexuality in torture. So in 2000, a former female combatant in the Algerian War published a memoir in which she spoke at length about her experience of torture and the sexual dimensions of the way in which women were tortured, and you know, many of those same practices were used on male prisoners as well. And that unleashed a whole return to what kind of torture was practiced, who knew about it, who had authorized it, whether it was legitimate or not, with some of the major French officers who had been in command during the War of Independence contradicting each other or changing positions. In one case, famous General Massu, who had been the supreme commander, basically, reversed his earlier position on the Battle of Algiers and said that actually torture wasn't justified, having earlier defended it. Whereas Osares, who you mentioned earlier, continued to be a significant apologist for torture, leading to a series of lawsuits going back and forth. So as recently as 2000-2002, there were a lot of books appearing with the words Battle of Algiers in their titles that revisited the history. And I think it's become very difficult to revisit the history of the Battle of Algiers without processing that through the film, The Battle of Algiers, and that also revisit the question of torture.
When I first arrived in this country 39 years ago now, this country is not very good in geography. It's not really a topic that's a high priority in K-12. And yet, almost every American that I just met and told them where I was from, they would go, wait, Algeria. I've seen the movie. I saw the movie, Battle of Algiers. It was such a famous movie. Even those who didn't know much about Algeria had seen or heard about this incredible movie.
Yes, it's a mixed blessing, I think, right?
Yes. So one of the things about your paper, Battle of Algiers, from the 1960s radicalism to the classrooms of West Point, was that both sides, people on the left, people on the right, nobody was completely satisfied with that film because it was so honest and didn't really shy away from much of what had actually happened. But you say in your paper that you wish this film had shown some of the not-so-romantic sides of the Algerian Revolution, like dissensions within the movement, the FLN, fratricidal killings, violence basically unleashed not just against the French, and not all French were culpable. We see in the film a scene that will always stay with me is that little French kid who's innocently licking his ice cream before the bomb explodes. So this whole question of the dirty dimensions to this ostensibly romantic movement, tell us why it bothered you a little bit that you didn't see more of that.
It's not so much that it bothers me that those things are not shown. I mean, certainly it has bothered some viewers of the film. People from different points of the political spectrum have taken issue with different things that are in the film or not in the film. What I was reflecting on more is the fact that for the article, I spoke with quite a few people who are involved in PME, professional military education. As I said at the beginning, I really wanted to understand who's showing the film in a military or in a policy context, why, what the goals are, and to get beyond the assumption that there was one screening at the Pentagon, it was an act of tremendous naivete and hubris, and the assumption was somehow that the U.S. would prevail, like the French paratroopers failing to draw the final conclusion that you can win the battle and lose the war. That narrative, I was pretty sure that that would turn out not to be enough. And in fact, it's not enough. But I wanted to know what actually is going on. If so many students who I've had who are veterans have seen the film. And so I talked to people in, you know, at West Point, at the U.S. Military Academy, at the National Defense University, in various strategic centers that report to the Department of Defense. So other people who have all lectured on the film or taught the film and who are either military or in professional military education roles. And it was fascinating. And for the most part, I would say their attitude was not especially doctrinaire. So they were all very prepared for their students or the people they were presenting the film to identify with Ali Lapointe or to, and they wanted to raise questions about what is terrorism, who is a terrorist, who defines what a terrorism is or who a terrorist is. So that aspect of it was fairly open-minded. Where it seemed to me to fall more into a kind of problematic mode is that there's kind of an assumption that the film conveys the reality, that the film isn't so much treated as a film as it is treated as a mirror of history. And that isn't interrogated very much. So the way torture is presented in the film must be the way torture was, or the way the FLN is presented in the film must be the way the FLN worked. First of all, if you're doing military strategy, it seems a little bit problematic to base it on a fiction film. If you're deciding whether it's a good idea to decapitate the leadership of an organization or not, it's important to say this is a movie. You know, this is not necessarily how the organization actually worked. And that seems to be a bit missing. There seems to be a tendency to treat the film as testimony or some kind of information that you can mine for thinking about how the French military worked and how the, you know, how the Algerians worked. And it's in that sense that what's missing from the film becomes significant. So just, I mean, a few of the things that are missing are, as I said, the way torture is shown is not enough if you want to really speak about how torture actually operated in Algeria or how it has worked since in more recent conflicts in which the U.S. has been engaged. The film doesn't depict the role of women with historical accuracy. Hmm. The film draws strongly on Fran Fanon's reflections on gender and the Algerian Revolution.
How so? That's an interesting point you're making. How is the women's role not depicted correctly?
There's a former combatant of the war called Jamila Min Amran, who published a book based on interviews with many women who had been militants and revolutionaries, mm-hmm. that takes issue with the way in which women were basically in Algeria written out of the story, or just basically relegated to the role of supporters as opposed to participants and combatants. And she shows that women played a lot of different roles in the combat, including the ones that are portrayed in the film, which is really women who are setting bombs in the European quarter, in the milk bar and the cafeteria and the offices of Air France. In the film, one of the most powerful scenes of the film is one that shows the women transforming their appearance in front of a mirror.
Yes.
And the pulsing music of Ennio Morricone is particularly strong in that scene. It's a very dramatic scene. So they change from let's call it a traditional Algerian look, clothing, into European-style hairdos and clothes in order to go unnoticed, unquestioned as they cross into the European quarter. So it's a very powerful scene, but it's not particularly historically accurate to the extent that many, if not most, of the women who were setting off the bombs were young. They were part of the first generation of Algerians, and particularly Algerian women, to be educated, because there was not a lot of education in the French colonial system for, put scare quotes around the word native here.
Mm-hmm.
But these girls, a lot of them were in their late teens, early 20s. They had been educated. They were used to dressing in that style. So they actually didn't go through that process of transformation. Mm. And the film really shows them as very much subordinate to the male leadership. And in fact, in many cases, the women were much more educated. Ali Lapointe certainly was not educated. Fadi Yassif had some education. He had been a baker. He was literate, but he wasn't a highly educated person who had advanced studies or anything like that, unlike some of the women. So all of that is missing. Mm. It's partly because there's a very influential essay by Frantz Fanon. The English translation is Algeria Unveiled, about gender and the revolution, that imagines women unveiling themselves strategically to carry out revolutionary acts. You know, I'm sure there were many cases in which that was true, but there were also many cases in which that wasn't what happened. Mm. All of that to say that it's important to always to acknowledge the diversity of gender roles in a society, and all too often when Muslim societies are represented, gender is treated very homogeneously.
Very true. One of the main questions to me as somebody who springs from that background and has grappled with these questions all my life, one main question posed by the film, in my opinion, is the question of violence and justifying the means on both sides, not just on the correct side, which to me is the Algerian side. On both sides, what are the deep implications of violence over time? And I think we're still grappling with those questions today as we see all sorts of senseless violence. Of course, in this country, the most famous cases are those that happen in the West, like what happened in Charlie Hebdo, what happened in Belgium, what happened here in San Bernardino and Orlando, but pretty much throughout the Muslim world as well. Muslims suffering even more than others from this type of extremist violence. What do you imagine might be the influence of this particular movie on younger people who may fantasize themselves the new warriors, the new liberators, as happened during the civil war in Algeria in the 90s. A lot of Algerians, even though the French were no longer there, would just arbitrarily decide those who don't agree with, those who are not quote-unquote Muslim enough, are now the French. Those who are in the elites, those who are enjoying a Western-like lifestyle are the French. Have you pondered the lessons of this film?
Yes, it's such an important and complicated question. The film, I think one would certainly be deluded if one read it as anything other than a film that really sides with the Algerian cause. It clearly does, and if you can't see that, then there's a problem to begin with. However, it's certainly a film that, while it allows for the need for violence in that context, it engages in lament. Whenever there are deaths, it treats those deaths with a lot of dignity. It's often noted that the same elegiac music is used when French extremists set off a bomb in the Kasbah, in fact, an event that precipitated the shift into terrorism by the FLN, so that the Algerian dead from that bomb, is the music that we hear, is everything is slowed down.
Like a requiem type of music.
Yeah, exactly. And then the same music is heard after the revolutionaries set off bombs in the European quarter, and we see the dust settling, and there's nothing graphic. There isn't graphic images of the dead, just hand or something like that, that really suggests the carnage. So in that sense, the film slows down to remind you that whatever the cause, it's important to acknowledge that violence is violence, that it has consequences for people, whatever side they belong to, and that in addition to those who are combatants, there are always those who are civilians, family members, passers-by, who end up being victims. So the film is very clear about that. It's obviously inspired some people to embrace military action, perhaps in some cases very justified, in other cases very questionable. So people are going to, as in the case of any work of art that is in the public domain, the emotional response and the lessons that are drawn are going to be different.
Any rich work of art like this, you'll find, as the French say, plenty to eat and plenty to drink from it.
Absolutely.
It's an expression that means you can find anything and it's contrary, depending on your personal inclination.
From the Algerian side of things, which we haven't said that much about, I mean, you know, something that comes up a little bit is, I think that the assumption that we could have is that the film depicts the fact that you can win the battle but lose the war. So the French win the Battle of Algiers, clearly, but a couple of years later there's a kind of a popular insurrection. There's a lot of political discontent linked to the practice of torture in particular, and so the nationalist cause revives and prevails. It's not a very clear account of the way things actually played out, but the film kind of presents things in that way. But, you know, I suppose there's an additional question, which is, did Algeria won? Algeria became an independent nation and necessarily threw off the bonds of colonialism, which were very, very oppressive bonds. But there are also ways in which Algeria lost. The peace was not won in the best way. So people have speculated on if the French campaign had not decimated the leadership and led to the creation of an external Algerian army that later came to power in a coup d'etat, you know, would things have happened otherwise? Did the French campaign have a different kind of, I don't even know that I want to call it a victory, but long-term consequence for the political future of Algeria?
Yes, and the question again of violence and the end justifying the means didn't stop in 1962, unfortunately.
Right.
And this logic of, I've got the weapons and I'm the boss, I'm the president, never really stopped after that. And I think throughout the Arab world, we're still grappling with it as we speak. You have people like Assad right now, who's an extreme case, of course, who's decided to decimate his own people. That we're still grappling with 50, 60 years later, that violence somehow is the organizing principle and not democracy and human rights.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the violence of colonialism and the violence that was required to emerge from colonialism has certainly lingered in these post-colonial states, of course, with many influences from outside, be they from the United States or Europe or the Soviet Union. There are numerous ways in which those dynamics of violence are not just ones that have taken shape within countries such as Algeria or Syria. You brought up the Algerian, what's sometimes called the Algerian Civil War of the 1990s,
yes,
also sometimes called the Black Decade, in which something like 200,000 Algerians were killed in a struggle between the state and a group of Islamist militias over a period of a decade. One of the arguments that's sometimes made about that conflict is that it foreshadows things that are happening now in Egypt and particularly in Syria, where the state will just basically go to any length to maintain its hold on power. So Algeria, which certainly was a kind of the emblematic war of decolonization in the late 50s and early 60s, I think if we look closely, we would see that although it's often neglected in American foreign policy circles, and certainly it's neglected in American academia in comparison with the Middle East, that things happening in Algeria in the late 80s and into the 90s are very much very similar to things happening now elsewhere.
And also in many ways similar to the War of Independence in some perverse ways. The whole question of there are no innocent when you're the enemy was never resolved, and it came back to haunt us a generation later among ourselves. We didn't need the French anymore to have such a war. So these questions of violence being on the one hand seemingly indispensable when you have no choice, on the other hand, does it really solve everything?
Right. Well, there's a tremendously important philosophical moment in the movie where Ali Lapointe is being schooled, basically, by one of the historic leaders of the revolution, the only one who's portrayed in the film, Larbi Ben Mahidi, who we later see being arrested by the French, and then he's reported to have committed suicide, although it's, of course, given to be understood that he's been killed. But he says to Ali Lapointe, this is the easy part.
Yes, that line is an incredible line. And he said it. He's known to have said it. He's one of our great heroes. He said, getting rid of the French colonial rule yoke is the easy part. The hardest part remains to be accomplished, and that is building something after the French
right.
are gone.
Well, by the time the film The Battle of Algiers was made, it was being filmed just, you know, at the same time that a coup d'etat was happening to overthrow the government of the first president of Algeria, Ahmed Ben Bella. So the coup d'etat of Houari Boumediene, who was the head of the Algerian army, had just occurred when the film was being made. So in the back of the minds of the filmmakers, even though this is one of the other things that really isn't rendered present in the film, is this roiling, internecine conflict, struggle for power among the various leaders. And, you know, I think, again, we could extrapolate and say that it's a power struggle that the French helped to create. You know, if they forced the hand of the revolution in a certain way to become what it became.
But at the same time, yeah, this logic of brute force was never seriously ask in the beginning who Ben Bella, the first president, who was placed by Boumediene, who was his minister of defense, he himself had created his own coup d'etat post-independence. He hadn't allowed for any democratic choice by the people.
Right. Well, I mean, sadly, in the film, we hear communiques that were issued by the FLN during the period known as the Battle of Algiers. So this period in 1957 when there's a call for a general strike and the FLN is appealing for recognition to the United Nations. So they're really trying to grab the attention of the population and of the world at the same time. So we hear these communiques being issued that were delivered or written and delivered by one of the most important political leaders of the revolution, Aban Hamdan, who
Aban
was
Hamdan,
just a few
yes.
months later killed by other...
His rivals within the FLN.
Right.
He was the most brilliant mind in a group, and he was taken out. The Algerians never got to choose him or anybody else. Not Aban Hamdan, not Larbi Ben Mahidi. None of them survived the war.
Madeleine Dolby is a professor of French and comparative literature at Columbia University. You can read her piece on the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Algiers at vomina.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. She spoke with Khalil Bendit. You can see the Battle of Algiers at Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley and Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco. For showtime schedule in the Bay Area, visit vomina.org.
That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com, connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
CUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Ralph Nader, Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. I recorded this talk on October 18, 2016, just 3 weeks before Election Day. A group of young people handed out Bernie-crat flyers to the audience that had already filled the small City Lights bookstore in San Francisco to capacity an hour before Ralph Nader was expected to arrive. Nader was going to talk about his new book, published by City Lights, under the title Breaking Through Power. From the advance reviews, we knew that he was not going to advocate for any party, blue, red, or green, in spite of his own former affiliation with the Green Party, and not even for Sanders in particular. He was going to lay out a specific plan how to take power ourselves and apply it directly to Congress without the mediation or intervention of any party. In what many experience as an age of powerlessness of ordinary people, that may seem like a far-flung goal, but you will hear in a moment how simple it actually can be. Nader's own life story and success in standing up to power, be it for car safety, healthier food, clean environment, and for a safer workplace, for more than 5 decades. All that shows that even one person with a small staff and organization can have a lasting influence. And he probably has affected all of our lives in some way. Add to that examples of other individuals who Nader mentions by name, who prevented industrial toxins from poisoning their children or fighting for safe water and air. We have an abundance of examples of breaking through power. In his book and talk, Nader lays out a very concrete plan of how to expand these individual stories into a coherent movement that is specific in its goals, can unite left and right, and takes power on a national scale. Here's Ralph Nader. The first to step up to the microphone was Elaine Katzenberger, editor of City Lights. She introduces Matt Gonzalez, who introduces Nader.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to City Lights. This is a very special night indeed. I believe it's the first time ever that Ralph Nader is here at City Lights Books, and it's certainly the first time that we have published a book by Ralph Nader. So this is a really proud and wonderful evening for us. It's really an honor to be his publisher. Ralph Nader is a hero, obviously. So first up is Matt Gonzalez, who will be introducing Ralph for you. Matt Gonzalez is chief attorney of the San Francisco Public Defender's Office and the former president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. And he very valiantly ran for mayor here against a machine and didn't quite make it. That was really very grateful. I think we should all be grateful for Matt. He's a recipient of numerous awards, including the 2000 Lawyer of the Year Award, In Defense of Animals Guardian Award, and the Bert Corona Award from the California's Mexican-American Political Association. Matt continues to do all kinds of work for the city of San Francisco, and all of us are lucky to have him here. Please welcome Matt Gonzalez. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a real delight to be here. I don't think I've seen Ralph Nader since 2008. And, of course, 2016, we would be just at the end of our second term in office. I'd like to think our Attorney General, Jello Biafra, would be filing lawsuits against Donald Trump. Interior Secretary Winona LaDuc would be shutting down the Dakota Access Pipeline. Secretary of State Cornel West would be with our U.N. Ambassador Julian Assange in Syria. But, you know, I'm kidding, but there is something to be said about what could be, you know. And I think that this book that Ralph has written is really about citizens taking back the power that they truly have. And I don't know if you want to, you know, refer to it as capitalism or neoliberalism or whatever you want to call it, but the system in place, you know, allows people to be satisfied with the table scraps, you know, the breadcrumbs. And this book is really about trying to ignite something with people. It says, hey, the kitchen's over there, the cupboard's full of food, you know, do something about it. I remember being with Ralph in Ohio, and a journalist asked me, what are the two of you doing to get into the debates? And I said, well, what are you doing to get us in the debates? You know, and I think it just goes to the core of what this is all about. Ralph was born in Connecticut in early 1934. Unsafe at Any Speed was published the year I was born. I'm 51, give you an idea. His long-term activism in pushing forward legislation, you know, whether it's the Freedom of Information Act, Clean Water, automotive safety, all kinds of things. He really is, as Elaine said, a legend, and I'm delighted to see him again, and this is really a very fine book, and I'm glad you're all here. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Matt. Yeah, it was a very frustrating campaign. Not 20% of the people knew we were running. It's a total blackout. You know, I think we got 4 minutes on the national news in 10 weeks. And it was all devoted to how do you feel spoiling the Democrats. So we're dealing with a tyranny, a two-party tyranny, that excludes competition in all kinds of legal and illegal ways. Legal because they control the state legislature and require, for example, 300,000 signatures here in California for an independent candidate to get on the ballot, because you got to get double the number because they disqualify so many signatures. When you don't have a competitive election, you're not a democracy, period. That's what it's all about. It's a duopoly, and they're strumming the tune of Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. So this book is designed to break it up, and it's a very short book. I've learned to pay attention to short attention spans of our present culture. And what is involved, let me just flip it. If I was a betting person and I could get a surety, I could say, tap one of those mega billionaires in Silicon Valley who has a conscience or enlightened, and for $1 billion, we can turn the country around. So this is just a challenge. How would you turn the country around if somebody gave you $1 billion in 36 months to do it? And when you ask students that, you know, the best, quote, universities and working in political science and anthropology and so on, they don't have a clue how to answer it. I've had answers like, well, you increase voter registration. I've had answers why you start a third party. They don't have a clue because they never ask the question, as Matt said, what if? If you don't ask the question, what if, you can't envision real possibilities. And we don't have a practical utopian culture where we ask the question, what if? What if we had 1,000 organizers full-time on the ground, two in every congressional district, and 10 or 15 on Capitol Hill in Washington to push full Medicare for all? What would happen? We'd get it. Because you have left-right support for that. It's cheaper, it's better, it's less anxious. You just need a card like Canada, and you're set. And you have a free choice of doctor and hospital, which you don't have with all these networks and all the complexities, mind-blowing exemptions, deductibles, complex deductibles, and all the nonsense that fritter away people's time and increase the anxiety level of millions of people. And then they don't end up getting health insurance covered when they need it. And you know how many people are working on that now, full time? My best guess, zero. They've agreed to settle it. You got a gridlock Congress. Forget about it. You got Obamacare. Now is not the time. Zero. We would audit the Pentagon with $1 billion. You easily could get the Pentagon audited because it's violating federal law since 1992. The only department agency that doesn't provide an audit to the GAO accounting arm of Congress. It's only $650 billion, not counting all the dark budgets, a year. Therefore, they couldn't account for $9 billion lost in Iraq in the first year of the criminal invasion. The Air Force buys billions of dollars of supplies because they don't have audited warehouses that have those same supplies, and on and on. So how would you spend $1 billion? Here's what I would do. I would organize about 2,000 people in every congressional district. Because when you say, well, how do you want to change the country? Well, some of it we can do ourselves. You know, we can put solar panels up, and we can eat nutritious organic food, and we can do this and that. And that's important. You practice what you preach, and you build awareness. But for better and for worse, Congress is the Khyber Pass. Congress is the most powerful branch of government, and it happens to be the most personal branch of government, and it happens to have a name on 535 people, and they put their shoes on like you and I do every night, and they want to get reelected, and it's nice to replace a lot of them, but if you had $1 billion, you wouldn't have to replace many of them. You just have to put the kind of pressure that on occasion we did in the 60s and early 70s and change corporate members of the Congress into consumer and environmental champions led by Nixon, who signed into law EPA, OSHA, Product Safety Commission, wanted to give the vote to the District of Columbia, had a better health plan than Clinton did years later, and had a minimum incomes plan to combat poverty. He was way ahead of Congress because he feared the people. He feared the rumble of the people from the 60s. He was the last Republican to fear liberals. It was all downhill after that. So you would basically hire 1,000, couple thousand seasoned organizers, put them in every congressional district, and depending on who represents the district, it could be the 20% really progressive members of Congress, you wouldn't have to unload on them as much, but you would organize 2,000 people in each district. Every district has community colleges, neighborhood leaders, lawyers, teachers, technicians, good blue-collar workers who don't take mush for an answer, etc. And you would say, we want you to commit 200 to 500 hours a year around a transformational agenda of, say, a dozen directions, which I'll point out, and we want you to raise or contribute $200 to $300 a year to open up full-time offices of 3-4 people in every congressional district, so all this volunteer time connected with all the other Congress watchdog groups around the country can have full-time advocacy. All right, so that costs about $100 million to do that a year before it gets self-sustaining. So you got money left over. You got $1 billion. What do you do with the rest? You open up an in personam lobbying effort right on Capitol Hill. The most successful lobbyists do not have marches and demonstrations. I am all for marches and demonstrations. You get new people in, you get some reasonable press, and you arouse people's sense of possibility. But what happens when these marches and demonstrations are overwhelmingly on weekends and the energy goes into the ether? It's not focused laser-like on what? 100 senators and 435 members of the House. Now, the most successful lobbyists, have you ever seen a mass demonstration in Washington and San Francisco by the military-industrial complex demanding more nuclear subs and F-35s? They don't operate that way. They know everything about those 535 that's possible to know. Their votes, who owns them, who they play golf with, who's a doctor, accountant, lawyer, clergyman, staff. They pump money in, and they have all kinds of dossiers. And they basically say, if you don't want a primary challenger, it's sub rosa, for those who resist a bit. And they get a majority. 1,500 corporations get a majority of the members of Congress, and they don't have a single vote. What are we doing out here? Reading muckraking books? Terrific documentaries? Golden Age. Can't imagine how much of this country is exposed down to the iota by reporters, editors, organizers. And where's it going? Do you ever read the last page of these books? Gerrymander, where are you? Yeah, Jerry. Jerry, you know, and I liked the book that came out called Not So Fast. It's a critique of technology and bad analysis of repercussions. The companies accentuate biotech, nanotech, artificial intelligence, and other, you know, medicines. They don't talk about the risks and all the other unintended so-called consequences. And I read the book. It's a really good book. It shows all the conflicts over 50, 60 years, worrying about the bomb, what happens when you get the bomb and it gets proliferated, worrying about all these other technologies. And the last page completely tailed off, left the reader with nothing. And that's done again and again and again. So where are we with massive disclosure? We're overwhelmed and overloaded with information. How about connecting knowledge to action? The old Ming Dynasty philosopher who said in the 14th century, I don't know, the wisdom of the ancients, how do they get this wisdom? No email, no fax machine, no telephone, no Facebook account? I mean, what's going on here? Listen to this wisdom. Quote, it's 14th century. To know and not to do is not to know. End quote. Marcus Cicero, over 2,000 years ago, Roman lawyer, freedom is participation in power. We define freedom as, you know, get off my back, don't invade my privacy, don't assault, don't surveil. I mean, that's freedom from. It's freedom to that we've got to demand. We don't have civic freedom in this country. We have personal freedom. We can buy the books, music, have our choose our friends, our clothes, what we want to eat. That's personal freedom. That's not civic freedom. Dictatorships allow personal freedom. And so, okay, so you have an in personam crew. All they do is go up on Capitol Hill. That's all they do every day. The corridors weave their way between the corporate lobbyists, get to know the staff, the reporters covering from back home, the senators, the representatives, the connections with the executive branch, etc. The kind of thing 360.org is trying to do back home. Do you know there isn't, to my knowledge, one person going up on Capitol Hill as we speak, lobbying on climate change? That surprise you, all the environmental groups? You know why? It's called gridlock. They've given up for the time being. So they lobby EPA, try to help the coal pollution reg. You know, they lobby the usual executive branch stuff. But Congress is like stasis. It's paralyzed. Can't get anything through. Total nonsense. I wrote a letter about 3-4 years ago to Tom Steyer, George Soros, and Al Gore. And they're all, you know, big on climate change. And, you know, they got a lot of money. And I said, put in $20 million a year and get 130, 140 people, really seasoned scientists, lawyers, public relations, organizers, whatever, to lobby Congress in personam on Capitol Hill every day. And to work the press, connect back home. You know what the answer was? Indirectly, through their staff. That's not where the action is. Really? When I go up on Capitol Hill, I bump into coal lobbyists, gas lobbyists, oil lobbyists, nuclear lobbyists. Somehow they think that's where the action is. All right, so what do you do with the rest of the $1 billion? Well, that's what we got to figure out. But here's what we can get in a 36-month period. You got to span an election. And you don't have to replace that many. Starts out 25% or so on our side from the get-go. Here's what we'd get. We'd get enough audit and pressure on the Congress, on the Pentagon, to de-bloat the military budget. The military budget is so crassly wasted, it staggers even a Nietzschean imagination. You wouldn't believe what's going on in terms of theft by the military-industrial complex. The waste, the duplication, the redundant weaponry designed for a Soviet Union era of hostility. We would smash most of the corporate welfare. That's a left-right support. See, the reason why we can win is I'm going to read you about 20 transformations that are supported left-right back home. And that's an unbeatable combination. You walk into a senator's office with 50 people or 20 people, and you say, we're conservatives and we're liberals, they turn pale. Because they can game the liberals if you're a right-winger or a liberal. They can game the conservatives. They cannot game a convergence. There's a book here by me called Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. So they don't like Wall Street over Main Street. The right-wingers want to break up the big banks. George Will writes columns saying, if banks are too big to fail, they're too big to exist. And Ron Paul and Barney Frank combined before they left the House to go after the military budget. There's a libertarian, liberal Democrat. You can see it. The reason why we don't see it in the headlines is because the divide-and-rule strategy of 2,000 years or more by the ruling powers is to focus on reproductive rights, gun control, you know, school prayer, those kinds of issues that, you know, if they're not superficially divisive, they are genuinely divisive, ideologically or religiously or what have you. We would have a living wage. That would be a slam dunk. You think the conservative workers in Walmart are going to fall on their axe and say, no, I don't want $15 an hour. I like $9.50 an hour. I'm a conservative. I want to conserve the money that the CEO of Walmart is paying himself, $12,000 an hour, not counting benefits. By noon, if he doesn't take a restroom break, by noon on January 2, he's earned more than one of any million Walmart workers in a year, not counting benefits. That's an easy one. Gather uncollected taxes. The IRS is being squeezed, so every dollar they lose, they can't collect $10 in taxes. What's the uncollected taxes? $400 billion. That's not counting tax, you know, tax havens and the shenanigans where GE doesn't pay any taxes because they've rigged the tax system. And they make billions of dollars and pay less taxes in dollars than one worker in GE. Billions of dollars of U.S. profits. We'd have a Wall Street speculation tax. How come we have to pay sales tax when we buy a book here, right? Yeah. Right? How come if someone buys tomorrow $100 million of Exxon derivatives, they don't pay a penny? Sales tax. And the volatility is fantastic. You're talking trillions of dollars in terms of derivatives. Tiny percent of 1% can produce hundreds of billions of dollars. The transforming into solar energy and efficiency from fossils and nuclear. That could be a transformational policy in place, 3% a year, as David Freeman has pointed out, used to run four public utilities, including SCUD and the TVA. 3% a year, in 30 years or so, we're out of there. No fossil fuels. No nuclear power plants. Oh, allowing standing to sue. One way they get us is there's this ancient doctrine that if you don't have a vested economic interest, you can't sue the government because they wasted your money or they criminally invaded another country. And so that knocks the judicial branch completely out of the three-branch concept of our government. And they basically say, the judges say, well, you're just a citizen, you're a taxpayer, you have no standing to sue, you can't even get into the courtroom door. Knocks out a lot of challengers of the corporate state, which is what we have now. We have a merger of big business, big government, with the big government thirsting to resign or leave high government posts to work for big business. That's the Wall Street, Washington merry-go-round. Expand direct democracy, not just in California. There are 25 states don't have the initiative to, referendum and recall, and there are other forms of direct democracy. So if our representatives don't represent us, they represent corporatism, for example, we just bypass them. And that has to couple with two other changes. One is campaign finance reform, public financing of public elections, so they can't use the California initiative against you, like the tobacco companies and others have tried to do. I mean, we'd be $80 million of insurance money in Prop 103 in 1988 with $2 million, because we had the LA Times and others on our side. And we've saved California consumers $100 billion, according to the leading actuary, J. Robert Hunter. But that's a rare thing. And the other one is, what are we doing giving away our public airwaves and monopoly cable license, getting nothing in return? I mean, to what level do we descend into the status of being saps? Right? We give the public airwaves 24/7 to commercial stations and quasi-commercial toadies like NPR and PBS. And they use it 24 hours a day. They use it 24 hours a day to decide who says what, who doesn't, who gets on and who doesn't. Most of it is entertainment and advertising. They take off the table huge voices of the people of concern about the depraved situation in our country, the deteriorating situation, self-censoring themselves to unimaginable profits, and they do it free. We charge them no rent. We're landlords. The FCC is our real estate agent, and they've made sure Congress says, you get it free. You turn that around. You say to Congress, no, little boys and girls, from now on, you're obeying us, the sovereign people, and we'll show you how we're going to enforce that with summons, formal summons for town meetings regularly. You report back to us. We control the town meetings. We're going to have the agenda. You're just going to listen and study and go back and do what you're told, because we have a left-right coalition, and we have the evidence and the humanity behind it. And so we should have our own audience network.
That was Ralph Nader, speaking 3 weeks before the 2016 election about his new book, Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think, offering encouragement and inspiration at a time when so many felt uneasy and powerless about the available presidential choices. Nader spoke for an hour, and you will need to come back for the next broadcast of TUC Radio to hear the conclusion. He spoke in the loved and respected over 60-year-old City Lights bookstore in San Francisco. Nader's new book had just been published by City Lights in the Open Media series. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So what we wanted to do was to be able to talk about what does democratic socialism mean to millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. And Bernie Sanders has done that.
That's the voice of economist Robin Hanel. This is segment 3 in a 4-part series on the economy. So stay tuned.
On our conversation about the economy, what is an economy? What is a productive economy? How do we create a participatory economy that engages people and inspires people with a vision of an inclusive, more just, and productive society? We talked about, you know, the beautiful example of Venezuela, you know, in the recent years of creating a participatory economy, an economy for the people, by the people, where you've highlighted that an economy that has populist redistribution can create beautiful possibilities where people can become engaged, and how the more participatory an economy is, the more people take ownership and responsibility for creating more of that. Can we talk a little bit about the barriers, the challenges we face, and what are some of the obstacles that make it difficult for us to create that kind of productive share economy?
Well, I mean, I think Venezuela, again, let's stick with that as an excellent example and learning experience. I mean, the first obstacle they faced was the complete and total hostility from the U.S. government, which aided and abetted a very tiny percentage of the population, the wealthy plutocracy, in an attempt, a military coup attempt to overthrow this government, which was nationalizing multinational interests that were not serving the interests of Venezuelans. And that was using things like the oil revenue, you know, to provide benefits for the poor population. So that's the first thing. You do face worldwide, but particularly in Latin America, and particularly as close as Venezuela is, and as close as the United States' involvement in Venezuela has been, Exxon Oil Company basically built itself into a world power on the basis of its ownership of the oil fields in Venezuela. The reason Venezuela has great baseball players is that Venezuela was very much a U.S. colony, you know, during the first half of the 20th century. So that's the first obstacle, that you face the implacable opposition of the U.S. government, the most powerful government and military force on the planet, and you're in our backyard. And you have to be a complete and total fool not to be aware of the fact, you know, that the U.S. is looking for any opportunity to throw you out of power as you move in this direction. The more you move in the direction we're talking about, because you're asking, what are the obstacles to moving in the direction that we've been talking about? Well, the more you move in that direction, the more implacable the opposition and the more intense the opposition from the U.S. government's going to be. And that's not going to change with Hillary Clinton. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there is an internal opposition. They have engaged in the kind of politics the Republican Party is engaged in vis-a-vis Obama for the past 6 years, scorched earth. They will do anything they can to create situations where there's chaos, where there's no food that's available. They will go out of their way to go ahead and create the conditions whereby people will lose faith in this government that's trying to move in this direction. And the harder you try and move in this direction, the more implacable their opposition will be. And they still control most of the jobs and most of the production in Venezuela. At some point, you're going to have to deal with that. I'd say there's two other things. One is political. Have people really figured out that we have sort of agreement about what are the steps that you take in order to build a participatory socialist, eco-socialist economy. Do we know how to do that? Is there agreement on how to do that? Do we have a plan in mind, or are we kind of winging it and feeling our way as we go? Well, we were very much doing the latter. So there was a government that was trying to feel its way toward what is this new kind of 21st century socialism going to be like? And it didn't really have sort of plans and strategies well worked out, that it had agreement amongst its own cadre and its own thinkers and its own leaders. That's the third problem, the third obstacle you have to overcome. The fourth obstacle is the one I was referring to briefly when I said most people have been told all their lives, and this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, you aren't smart enough and capable enough to make the important economic decisions that affect you. You just have to trust somebody smarter than you, somebody more clever than you, somebody better educated than you to go ahead and make those decisions. Or otherwise, the economy isn't going to work very well for you or anybody else. Has there ever been a time when human beings, since we lived in small clans where most economic activity was done through cultural institutions and it was self-directed activity, ever since we developed into societies that were class societies, class means a small number of people are ordering a large number of people. And we have been living in class economies and class societies for thousands of years. That is a tremendous inertia to overcome. It's a tremendous inertia to overcome. So those are the obstacles that need to be overcome in the case of Venezuela and in sort of general. And they're not easy. It's a very difficult path. I think it's important for all of us who see that as our goal in some broad sense to appreciate where it is that people have taken more steps and more successful steps along that path and have generated learning experiences for the rest of us. And that is my feeling about Venezuela. As sad as I am about the way things are going right now, I still have a tremendous respect and admiration for the fact that they have done more there than anybody has any place else to try and figure out how it is that we march on this difficult, difficult path to overcome these very difficult obstacles.
I agree with you that it's a strategy is very useful and is absolutely something we have to work towards. I would disagree that it's inevitable for us to make change without it, because we have seen that they did. What I would like to focus on perhaps is maybe how do we hold on to the gains that were made, being fully and wide awake to the challenges we are facing, because the challenges are many, but also the gains we have made are very palpable and real, and they have made significant transformations in the lives of people, primarily the poorest in Venezuela and in some of the regions that were affected by the changes they made.
My own sense would be if I were there and if I were involved in those discussions, I would be pointing out, look, we always should have been moving from serve the people in the direction of with power for the people. We've had that slogan around for a long time, since the 1960s. You can go back to the Black Panther Party here in the United States. And there's a big difference between we are trying to serve ordinary people, particularly poor people in need, and we are trying to empower them to take what is theirs and do with it what they decide to do. We always knew we needed to be making that transition. Now we face a situation where oil revenues are down, where the economy is in rather bad shape. You know, export prices have fallen for things other than oil, where there's less and less medicines in the clinics, not more and more clinics with more and more medicines. So we're in a situation where we actually don't have as much to redistribute in order to sort of serve the interests of the masses of Venezuela. The only way to go forward is to basically empower them to take the power themselves. There's two ways to respond to the fact that there's less to redistribute. One is to cut back on redistribution and just hope that you can hang on to political power until things get better. And I think that's unfortunately one of the tendencies. The other reaction is, okay, there is less to redistribute. We never wanted to be about redistribution in the first place. We wanted to be about empowerment. So let's crank up the energy and the ideas and the strategy that has to do with empowering people in a situation where we actually can't increase the amount of redistribution we're doing at this point anyway. But it's not easy. These are things that are easier said than done. Yeah. Let me put it that way. There's a lot in life that's easier said than done.
Wouldn't you agree then that the solution seems to be both, you know, in different contexts, almost the same one, you know, increase the power, increase the access people have both to the political levers by means of education, political education, but also sharing of, you know, the resources that are essential to life, to engagement, to participation.
But in the particular case of Venezuela, not only do you need to be working on empowering those people who have received material benefits from redistribution over the past 15 years, you need to be taking the power out of the hands of your enemies. And as long as you leave the major part of the economy in the hands of the private employers who are implacably opposed to a continuation of this government, they want to go back to the way Venezuela was in 1955. They want to go back to when the oligarchy in Venezuela was literally ruling over 95% of the population, who were simply destitute masses. Now you've got a huge chunk of the population that is going to, you know, would have a hard time stomaching that. So you need to empower them so that they can defend themselves, but you also need to take that economic power away from your political enemies. Instead of using oil revenues to make loans to start up small, you know, workers' co-ops, you actually, now that you have less rural revenues and you can do less of that, you need to actually go out and start taking over the businesses that have been deliberately sabotaging the economy, trying to get a political counter-revolution. You need to actually go out and start doing that. Now, why would you hesitate? Well, that's going to increase tension. That's going to further anger the opposition. That's going to further embolden the U.S. media and the State Department to say, oh my gosh, look what they're doing. They're expropriating private property in Venezuela. Yes, it's scary. On the other hand, if you don't move in that direction, where will it inevitably end? Right now, the trend is definitely in the wrong direction.
If you were appointed to President Maduro's council and you were to implement, you know, a recovery strategy, this very process of empowerment, what would be your top three recommendations as we moved into this period of unknown? Because, you know, we are making the road as we walk.
I would take the step which the Bolivarian Revolution has yet, I mean, what are we now, 15 years? And they have avoided any sort of large-scale nationalizations of the private sector. There have been some around the edges. There have been some that just sort of had to be done. That happens in countries that are not trying to build 21st century socialism. They really have done no more of that than countries, you know, that aren't trying to build 21st century socialism. They've put that off for a very long time. I can sympathize with why it was put off. It was put off because, first of all, it is provocative, and so you risk creating a political crisis. It was put off because I think they were incredibly honest. They said in the very beginning, well, what are we going to do if we tip over these private businesses? How will we organize people to run them? And the Cubans said, well, we'll show you how to do, you know, socialist planning Cuban style. And they said, but we don't think that works. That's not what we want. And I think they were right about that. So they were incredibly honest and said, part of the reason we're not going to take over private businesses are we have to learn and feel our way toward how to run them better. And so instead of just large-scale socialism, nationalization in the early years and having the Cubans come in and set up the Cuban planning system, instead of doing that, they very wisely started building the social economy slowly so they could figure out how do we want to run things. We don't want to take over anything that we don't know we can run better. But I think that they've had those years. They've done some of that. And at this point, they have to take that step. So I think they need to take over businesses that are being deliberately mismanaged in a way that is creating economic chaos inside Venezuela, all of which just discourages the population, discourages your supporters, and emboldens your enemies. I think they need to be much more aggressive about taking those over, and they need to go ahead and whatever they've learned about how you can run businesses non-capitalistically in these years with the social economy, they need to put it to good use and see how it goes.
So how do we take some of that responsibility, you know, of creating a social context where a beautiful revolution like the one that took place in Venezuela, and we call it a beautiful revolution because, you know, they didn't have to kill 50% of their people in order to liberate themselves and start dreaming of a socialist economy and start dreaming of a different way of connecting and creating that productive economy that serves all of the people, not just a few.
Sylvia, I'm very glad you said that. We need to step back and recognize what a momentous achievement it is to have moved as far as they have moved without having, you know, massive percentages of the population being killed in warfare. That's an incredible accomplishment, you know, that they should be proud of and that we should appreciate. You're Canadians, and it's a little different, except you basically just are part of our foreign policy. That's your problem. Your problem is have your own foreign policy and don't just hitch your wagon to the U.S. That's what you need to fight for in Canada. In the United States, the first thing that people need to do is we need to work to try and prevent our government from being the one that stops the Venezuelans from doing what they're trying to do. And the second thing is that those of us who want to have more progressive economies and societies, we need to learn lessons from what they've been doing in Venezuela. They have been doing things that we can learn lessons from. This is how you do this. This is how it works. This is where you're going to run into problems. This is how you cope with it. They're decades ahead of us, and we can learn from their experience. It doesn't mean we have to sit here and say everything that their government says that we agree with, that that's the right way to do things. But we should recognize that they have accomplished so much more than we have. They're decades ahead of us on the road we'd like to be on. And we need to keep our government from stopping them. That's the primary things that people in the United States can do.
As we approach the U.S. election, what are your hopes in terms of our social movements here and the moment that calls us at this time?
Well, it looks like Trump is imploding. It looks like Hillary Clinton would have to do something incredibly stupid to blow this election. Having said that, I would also say this is a year where all of the polls and all of the expectations have proven to be wrong over and over again, that the anti-establishment sentiment in the U.S. political in U.S. politics right now and in European politics right now, the anti-establishment political sentiment has never been higher for 50 years. And that makes it very difficult to be very confident about predicting electoral outcomes. But I am hopeful that Clinton will win. I'm hopeful that she will win in a landslide, because as long as the Republicans control the House of Representatives, they will continue to engage in scorched earth policy. Anything that requires a law to be passed, you know, to change at the federal level. If Clinton is elected, but the Republicans continue to hold on to the House, it makes it very difficult for us to make any sort of progress in terms of national policy and changes in national laws. That includes spending. That includes health care. So that's my fear. My expectation is we'll have a Clinton in the White House and the Republicans will be further embittered and in scorched earth mode over in the House of Representatives. So we'll have divided government just as we've had divided government under Obama. Let's leave Trump and the anti-establishment sentiment on the right wing of U.S. politics aside. Something has happened in the U.S. political scene that has not happened here probably in 80 years, and that is the Bernie Sanders, our revolution, the Bernie Sanders candidacy through the Democratic primaries has essentially mobilized people who are of a progressive mind, who are disgusted not only with Republicans and Tea Partiers, but the Democratic Party establishment presiding over 30 years of neoliberal economic policy and 30 years of increasingly dysfunctional imperial wars and interventions. That has been mobilized to a greater extent, you know, than my lifetime. I have long believed that the U.S. left needs a multi-pronged strategy. We need to build social movements. We need to build experiments in equitable cooperation. And we need some sort of productive way to engage in electoral politics, not just locally, but at the national level. I believe that because the United States is a very politically immature society. U.S. citizens, on average, spend less time thinking about politics than citizens in any other country in the world that I have ever been in. And that includes very poor countries. In poor countries, people are much more politically savvy and sophisticated than they are in the United States. On top of that, the little attention that most Americans pay to politics is focused on the 6 months before a presidential election. So how can you be a serious political movement and have no successful way of engaging with people when they're paying attention to political issues? That's been our dilemma. And we've had that dilemma now for presidential election after presidential election. Do we do third party? Do we do the Greens? Do we run safe state or do we run strategy? How do we approach this? And we have a very difficult situation because we are a two-party duopoly. We don't have three or four parties. We don't have a parliamentary system. So it's very difficult to figure out how do you participate as progressive forces in the U.S. political presidential electoral season, which is the time when you can actually talk to most Americans about anything political. We haven't had an answer to that, and I think Bernie Sanders has given us the answer. You have to run progressive candidates in the Democratic primaries. And if you win and you have basically taken over the Democratic Party, fabulous. If you don't win in the general election, you do not engage in a policy like, unfortunately, Jill Stein is with the Green Party, where she's still asking people to vote for her in the 10 states that could potentially swing the election to Trump. I think I've learned the lesson that, no, the Sanders campaign has provided us with a model, a successful strategy for participating electorally. And we should understand, we had no reason to expect that we were going to win the Democratic nomination through the electoral process this year. The progressive forces in the United States aren't big enough and strong enough to do that. So what we wanted to do was to be able to talk about what does democratic socialism mean to millions, hundreds of millions of Americans. And Bernie Sanders has done that. He has talked about what democratic socialism means to hundreds of millions of U.S. citizens. He has made it a word that isn't a bad word that nobody is, that everybody is afraid to even talk about. And he has pointed out and said over and over again, we are in a situation where people are totally disfranchised. People have no control over what their government's doing anymore. We need a political revolution. So we have a candidate who has said we need a political revolution. We have a candidate who has spoken in concrete terms what democratic socialism can mean and how much better it is than neoliberal capitalism. And he has successfully campaigned and set, and gotten that message out to hundreds of millions of Americans, came very close to winning the Democratic Party nomination. And there are now tens of millions of particularly young Americans who think I'm for democratic socialism, and I'm for a political revolution. That's a tremendous step in the right direction that we have taken during this electoral campaign. It rebounds to the benefit of people building social movements. It basically gives us that missing piece to our overall strategy that we always struggle with. So in that sense, I am very impressed with something that's happened that was beyond any of it was certainly beyond my expectations. I'll go out on a limb. I don't think Bernie Sanders or his closest advisors had a clue that they would be this successful. They never expected to be this successful. So it's a huge and pleasant surprise that we need to recognize the importance of in terms of how we plan about going ahead in the future. We finally, I think, have a basic formula for how we can combine electoral campaigning at the national level with all the other activities that we've been doing for the past 20 years.
We really need to recognize that the road ahead is not an easy one, but that the sheer success of Bernie's campaign reflects exactly that as a society, you know, we have the moral compass to move towards a society that's more, you know, that's built on reciprocity, that's built on interconnection with each other and with the environment, with the natural world. You know, in a society that really hungers for social justice and dignity that is, you know, to all, for all people, not just for a few and for those who can afford to buy it.
I was teaching on a campus this spring, and I was just amazed at how many of the students, this was at Lewis and Clark, which is a fairly affluent student population. I was amazed at just how powerful and overwhelming the sentiment for the Sanders campaign was on that campus. I mean, you look at the primary results, and I mean, he was getting, in the Democratic primaries, he was getting 85% of the vote under 30. From 18 to 30, 85% were voting for a guy who's older than me who's saying, I'm a democratic socialist and we need a political revolution. So in terms of who it is that has been turned on to the kind of ideas, values, politics that we have all believed in for decades and decades. I mean, Bernie did an incredible job of turning the American youth, putting them on a path where they're thinking in the right direction. They're very clear about what they want, and they're very clear about what they're disgusted with. And on those two issues, they're absolutely dead right. They're much more clear-headed than most older Americans are at this point. And the youth's always the future, so there is that to be hopeful for.
Thank you so much for being with us. I highly recommend that people buy your books and support your efforts as well, because you truly are a gift. Thank you very much for all that you do, and thank you for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Sylvia, and good luck to you Canadians.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.